Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Who Wars, episode number 31. You know, we really are the podcast for those among us who just can't decide between Star Wars and Doctor Who, and I'm your host, Rob Irwin. How are you? How's your week been? Mine's been busy, I seem to always say that, and a lot of stuff's been going on, but you know what? Right here at the start of the show, I've got to say something. I am a bad Doctor Who fan. I am a terrible Doctor Who fan, because apparently Matt Smith is currently touring the country with Karen Gillan. I think he's had Freema Agyeman with him at other times, and Alex Kingston might be along for the ride as well. And I had no idea this was going on. It's a series of events run by a very reputable company, but I've just not seen any advertising or even any fans mentioning it on my Facebook feed or my Twitter feed or anything like that. And the first I knew of it, the Sydney event had come and gone. Whoosh. But you know what? I probably wouldn't have gone anyway, even if I knew. I'm a bit funny with big events and fan events and things like that. So even if I'd known, I might not have gone along and paid my $80 for a Matt Smith autograph and all that sort of stuff. I was having a look at the website earlier. And speaking of paying for autographs, if you wait around until the end of the show where I do my back page editorial, that's actually the topic I cover there. Yes, very interesting. Anyway, what else happened this week? Well, Star Wars Armada arrived in the mail. What's Star Wars Armada, you might ask? Well, it's basically a tabletop game, and it uses pre-painted miniatures. If you're familiar with the Fantasy Flight game X-Wing, which involved lots of small ships like X-Wings and TIE Fighters and TIE Advanced and the Millennium Falcon and Boba Fett's Slave One and all sorts of ships like that. If you're familiar with that game, Star Wars Armada is similar. It's a different rule set, though, and the ships involved are capital ships. So you've got Star Destroyers and Corvettes, and you have the smaller ships like X-Wings and TIE Fighters, but they're in smaller squadrons. They're not single ships. They're clustered together as squadrons. It's basically a game of capital ship combat, you know. Not dissimilar to when you play a World War One or Two game of battleships or even, you know, play games with sailing ships on the tabletop. If there are any war gamers out there, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And I'm really looking forward to trying it out. It's been out for about 2 months, apparently. They're already knocking out expansion packs with extra Star Destroyers and extra squadrons of ships, and I think a Mon Calamari cruiser might be in there and so on. So I'm going to sit down if I can with my wife, who some of you know as Leo from previous Star Wars Rebels reviews last year, and we're going to play it. And hopefully she'll join me to talk about what it's like, maybe on the next episode. So that's quite exciting, isn't it? Anyway, moving on, we have a letter here from Doc Hume of the Diddly Dum podcast. Doc has been a guest on this show before, and I can let you in on something. Doc and I are cooking up an irregular sort of series that will make its debut on Who Wars at some stage this year, and could be a lot of fun. So a good friend of the show, Doc Hume, he writes, "Dear Who Wars, the new Force Awakens trailer confirms a plot rumour that I've heard from my spies on the Doctor Who Star Wars crossover grapevine. The central plot will be that R2 is carrying a secret hologram message from a young Han Solo to Chewie 30 years in the future, reassuring him that it's okay to have a much older, grey-haired man playing Han. Keep up the good work, Doc Hume." Nice one, Doc. For those among you who don't get that, probably the non-Doctor Who fans, it's a reference to a crossover episode when we crossed over from one Doctor to another in Doctor Who, and the previous Doctor called the Doctor's companion to say, "It's okay that I've now changed," if that makes any sense to you. You're probably thinking, what is this crazy Doctor Who stuff? I'm just here for the Star Wars. Okay, that's fine. But Doc, very cool email. All right, what else? I know I don't want to ramble on too much here, but I do want to mention, at the end of Andy's Princess Leia comic review in this episode, we do have a very special competition. Please listen to the full review before you get to the competition bit. Some of us on the team contributed in one way or another, and we had a lot of fun doing it, so please listen to that. But at the end of the review, there is a competition. The metric, which I'll put up front here, is we'd like an iTunes rating and review. Very simple. Just go on iTunes, leave us a rating and review, and you'll be in the running to win something pretty damn cool, but I might leave it for you to listen to before you learn what that prize is. Alrighty then, I think that's all I've got to say here at the start of the show. I'll see you again during the show in different ways, and then of course at the end of the show with the back page editorial, of course talking about paying for autographs and paying for meet and greets and conventions and all that sort of stuff, which is a topic I think that touches Doctor Who and Star Wars fans pretty much equally, and I hope you enjoy that. But before we get to that, there is a stack of stuff to come, so please enjoy, and on with the show.
So, I've been a pretty busy fangirl lately. When I'm not at Star Wars Celebration or recording or editing things for the podcast, I'm off to things like Star Wars book signings. So, on May 4th, yep, Star Wars Day, I headed over to Tempe, Arizona to go to a book signing for the Ultimate Star Wars book, and authors Trisha Barr and Adam Bray were there. And so I was excited to get this Ultimate Star Wars book. I'd been hearing about it. I didn't really realize how awesome it would be. You know, it's published by DK, and at one point I think I had the episode 1 visual dictionary. I think it was published by DK as well, you know, back in 1999. And that's kind of what I had in my head, maybe a little bit bigger because I knew this was fully encompassing like all of Star Wars. But that book was about 65 pages, somewhere in there. It was really cool. I remember it. You know, it has all the little pictures of costumes, the characters, the planets, blah, blah, blah. But I actually looked through that book so much, I think the pages fell out of it. I don't think I have that book anymore. But anyway, so I went to the bookstore. I picked up my book. And immediately, I was just stunned by the sheer magnitude of this book. It is massive. It's like a textbook. It's a Star Wars textbook. It's 300 plus pages of fully illustrated Star Wars goodness. It's the first comprehensive reference guide of its kind since the new era of Star Wars canon. So it includes, you know, of course, stuff from all of the 6 movies, and then everything from the Clone Wars and Rebels. And so it's kind of a nice time period we're in right now if you want to catch up on where Star Wars is at before we head into all this new stuff with The Force Awakens and all the new movies and things that are going to be coming out soon. So it's organized in a pretty interesting way. It's got 4 different categories. So it's characters and creatures, locations, technology, and vehicles. And within that, it's arranged chronologically, I believe. And so it's just very visually appealing layouts, timelines, pictures, all kinds of stuff. I've only made it about a third of a way through, and that's like just kind of skimming through the pages and flipping them really quick. There's so much information here. So, yeah, you definitely want to have this book if you're a Star Wars fan. I can't stress that enough. I'm really impressed with the writing in this book, too, because it's done by 4 different authors, and I'm sure they all have their individual writing style, but this book is so cohesive, you can't really tell which author has written what, unless you already know beforehand. And so I thought I would just talk a little bit about each of the authors, and then I'll play you the questions that I asked from Adam Bray and Trisha Barr at the end, but so, yeah, it's Adam Bray, Trisha Barr, Dan Wallace, and Ryder Windham. So, yeah, Dan Wallace, he's done some cool stuff lately, like regarding Rebels. He wrote for the Sabine and Ezra sketchbook things. And then he's done, like, some cool stuff like the Jedi Path, the Book of Sith, Essential Characters, stuff like that. Ryder Windham, he has written, I think I read somewhere over 70 Star Wars books. He has a lot of experience writing for Star Wars, and he's done a lot of specifically like the reference books, so he was awesome to have for this book. Now for Trisha and Adam, they're the ones I got to meet, and they signed my book. Actually, let me read you what they signed in my book too. I have my book right here. I actually would like to get Dan and Ryder to sign it at some point too, maybe even Anthony Daniels since he did the foreword. That would be awesome. Okay, but anyway, so Trisha Barr says, Kate, the Force has awoken, hashtag BB-8, because we both love BB-8. Woo! And she signed her name. And then Adam says, hi, Kate, this is where the fun begins. And then he signs his name and May the 4th, since it was on May the 4th. So that was really cool of them. I hung around till after everyone left to kind of, I mingled with the stormtroopers, and then they were nice enough to answer some questions for Who Wars. So that was really awesome of them. So if you guys are listening, thank you so much. It was so cool to meet you. But yeah, so Trisha Barr, she is so cool. I enjoyed meeting her so much. I'm a big fan of her work on the podcast Fangirls Going Rogue. So yeah, she's just mega Star Wars fan. She cosplayed Leia in 1977 when she was a girl, so that was awesome. And she also has a lot of experience writing. She has written a novel called Wind, which is cool. And then Adam Bray, this guy is just pure awesome. He has a background with travel writing, so he's been all kinds of cool places. He's worked with animals, and now he's able to write for Star Wars, which is amazing. And so he's written some of the things like the Star Wars Monster Guides and the Rebels Visual Guide. So he's also very well qualified to be writing for Ultimate Star Wars. So yeah, very cool to be able to meet him and Trisha. So why don't I go ahead and play you the clips I have of Adam and Trisha. All right, I'm here with Adam Bray. All right, so the question is Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Oh, I'd have to say Star Wars, but I love Doctor Who.
Oh, awesome. Very cool. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about why you love Star Wars?
Yeah, well, I think the big reason why I love Star Wars so much is because it's part of my earliest memories.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 3 years old, I remember seeing Star Wars at a drive-in movie theater with my parents. And I remember the little box speaker outside the window crackling.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the Jawas load R2-D2 up on his sand crawler on the screen, you know, outside the car window. And my first toys at my third or fourth birthday, the presents were the Millennium Falcon and that first wave of Star Wars action figures. So
awesome.
It's been a part of my life from the very beginning.
Very cool. So, which character in Star Wars do you most relate to?
Oh, which one do I most relate to? That's a hard one. Maybe Chewbacca. Maybe Chewbacca, because I've always been a big guy. Even when I was a little kid, I was taller than all the kids in the class. And you know, I was, you know, beat up on, you know, a bit by the bullies in the class. Kind of the way the crew of the Millennium Falcon, they love Chewbacca, but they kind of beat up on him. You know,
yeah.
they call him a walking carpet and things like that. So yeah, but Chewbacca always takes it in good stride, and
right.
He's loyal. So I identify
so
with him.
This is kind of a tangent, but I noticed on your Amazon profile it said something about your first job was it chimpanzees?
Yeah. Actually, I worked here in Mesa,
oh,
Arizona,
wow.
About 16 or 17 years ago.
Okay.
A place called the Primate Foundation
cool.
of Arizona that
awesome.
Had chimpanzees.
So, do you notice any correlation, like with the apes, like that, to like Star Wars creatures?
Not so much. maybe more with something like Lord of the Rings,
okay.
with Andy Serkis
gotcha.
Being involved in that and Planet of the
yeah,
Apes. Yeah,
awesome.
With the costume tonight.
Okay. Uh-huh. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got Trisha Barr here. All right, so the time-honored question for the Who Wars podcast, Star Wars or Doctor Who?
I have watched very little of Doctor Who, but my good friend and co-host on Hyperspace Theory,
uh-huh.
Geek K, is now into it. She's totally hooked
oh, really?
On it, and she is always telling me about different things and talking to me about it, so
yeah.
she's convincing me to watch it
oh,
and
awesome.
Go along. So,
cool.
So it has to be Star Wars.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about why you love Star Wars?
I saw it when I was a little girl in
mm-hmm.
1977 at the movie theater. I was hooked. I think pretty much anybody who was in the theater back then,
yeah.
that's what they say happened to them.
Yeah.
And Princess Leia really resonated for me, and so did the journeys of Han Solo and Luke Skywalker
mm-hmm.
and you know, what happened in the story. It's mythological and it's timeless, and everybody wants to have a hero. So I think there's a reason that it connects with so many people.
Absolutely. Well, you kind of already answered the other question I was going to ask. Let me think of something else. If you could travel to any planet in the Star Wars universe, which one would you like to take a vacation at? How about that?
I would say Alderaan, but that's a dangerous
prospect. As long
prospect.
As it's before, pre-Death Star, right?
Way pre-Death Star.
Yeah, Alderaan would be, it seems nice.
Yeah, and they're doing a lot with Princess Leia comic to just
I love that comic.
Explain a little bit more about the culture.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And but then really my favorite place that I, if it weren't Alderaan, would be Naboo. I would
Naboo's really nice too. Cool. All right, well thanks.
Thank you.
All right.
So thanks again, Trisha and Adam. It was so nice to meet you guys, and hopefully we'll cross paths again someday. And Ryder and Dan, the invitation is open to come on to Who Wars and talk the wars anytime at all. All right, guys. So if you don't already have Ultimate Star Wars, you need to go out and get this book. You won't regret it. It is an awesome addition to any Star Wars fan's library. Hey everybody, we got something special for you this time for the Titans Doctor Who Free Comic Book Day issue. We've got a special review for you with Lex.
Hello.
Andy.
Hello.
And me.
Hi.
Right. Okay, so Free Comic Book Day, guys. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about your Free Comic Book Day experience?
Yes, we definitely should.
Okay, awesome. Who wants to go first?
Lex, go first.
Go ahead, Lex.
Well, the reason why I'm so enthusiastic about talking about the Free Comic Day experience is because I didn't actually have it.
Oh.
Did you see that one coming? Did you guys?
Ooh. Twist.
Yeah. I was traveling the entire day on Free Comic Book Day, so I couldn't go to a comic book place until a couple days afterwards, and I had to go to numerous locations, and by numerous, I mean two, but it was difficult, and I had to beg for the comic to check. Well, I didn't beg. They were very nice, but the second place, they played a game on me. They pretended like they didn't have it and then quizzed me on my favorite doctor. I said the 11th, and luckily they approved of my answer and revealed that they had one left over. All of them were gone. So that's why I wanted to know, what was your guys' experiences like? It must have been pretty crazy, seeing as none of them exist in the United States anymore. So was it crazy? Tell me.
My first comic book day, Free Comic Book Day. And I went to a comic book shop that I don't usually go to, but it was just more convenient. They were only giving out two free comics per person. I was like, what?
Oh, that makes sense, though.
But I noticed that it was the last one. And so I rushed over there and I basically like just grabbed it. And I was like, okay, I don't even care about anything else.
Wow.
So I got it. And I got a Bob's Burger comic.
A what burger comic?
Bob's Burgers. It's a show on Fox.
Oh.
A cartoon. Yeah.
Well, I'm starting to regret not grabbing more after hearing your stories.
Yeah, what's your story, Andy?
Well, our comic book store is probably a really well-kept secret, to tell you the truth, where I live. Amazing Fantasy is its name. And I know he does a lot of his trade online, but I was quite shocked when I got there at opening time to see a queue of at least 20 people, which was a big queue for that particular shop. Anyway, it opened and he ferried us in and he was very nice to us. We got a pack, which they'd already put together of 7 comics.
Wow.
And then you were allowed to pick 3 more off the rack of your own choosing. So we got 10. But yeah, it was really good, actually. It was my first journey out to a free comic book day as well, so I got quite excited. I went through the door and I could see the rack and I could see the Doctor Who ones, of which there was, I hate to tell you, loads. And I'm thinking, shall I lean over and grab one now, just in case someone goes crazy? But no, it turned out okay. So yeah, I, uh, I was happy with my pack of seven, and I got a 2000 AD as well, and I got my Doctor Who one. So it was a great experience, and I took a picture outside when I got out because I was so happy and pleased with myself.
Yeah, I did that too.
Yeah.
What was the name of that comic place again?
It's called Amazing Fantasy.
Yeah, they're not kidding. It really is an amazing fantasy. That sounds like an excellent free comic day experience.
Yeah, it does very well online from what I can gather. So if anyone buys their comics off of Amazon UK in the UK, chances are they've come from Amazing Fantasy in Hull, because I know he puts a packing slip in.
So that concludes. I wish I had actually gone to a place so I could contribute more and tell you.
Yeah.
But should we talk about the comic that we've picked up?
Yes, we should. Mm. So right. what were your initial thoughts, everybody?
All right. Well, we got to go in order, right?
Well, should we just go right into, like, the brief overviews of each little story?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That's smart. If
we go in order, that'll be Andy first.
Okay. My 12th Doctor story is called The Body Electric. And it's... The synopsis here says the Doctor and Clara have an electrifying alien adventure on a planet made of quartz, which is indeed what they do. And it's a very seriously sciencey story, I've got to say, without giving too much of the plot away just yet. I don't know if I'm allowed to just yet. But yeah, it's very, out of the three stories, this is the most serious. And I wonder if it's probably best placed at the beginning, to tell you the truth.
Yeah,
it takes itself a little bit too seriously, probably. The Doctor's very well written in it, which if you've listened to some of my earlier 12 Doctor reviews, that's one of the things that I'd not been happy with. But this one, I think the fast pace of the story, the fact that it's only a few pages, they've crammed a lot more dialogue in, which of course the 12th Doctor has on screen. He does pack a lot of words into some very short spaces of time when he's giving his sentences, so perhaps that works better. Clara's pretty quiet in it. She doesn't say too much, but she, again, as is on telly, she is the hero at the beginning of the end, or so it's written. But, good characters in it. I'm happy with the drawings and the artwork. It's all looking very good. I might as well say now, the monsters in it are sentient electrons, which, at any time of the day is quite something to take in. But, it's a take on things that have been done in the past again, I think, isn't it? It's like sentient gas monsters and things like that. But, yeah, sentient electrons. So it's a great little story, but a little bit too serious for my liking.
So I would... Oh, go ahead.
It was definitely a theme of all of the stories that we had of sentient beings.
Right.
Being created or...
Yeah, I thought it was... Especially the 10th Doctor. I thought it was a little similar.
Yeah, this was definitely a sentient... mass of some sort, kind of a collection. Exactly. Is a mass appropriate? I don't know. Sentient things.
Yes.
Yes.
So out of 10 sonic screwdrivers, what scores would you give the story and the art, everybody?
Is this in comparison with the other stories?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well. Oof.
Yeah. I have to think about that too.
Yeah, I'm just checking if the artist is anybody I'm going to offend who I've got an interview coming up with or anything.
I know, right? I had to think about that, too.
these writers are very sensitive people, and the artists, too. Now we've read the 11th Doctor comic story, too. They're very sensitive, guys.
I'll confess that the artwork is... I'm not so keen on the actual drawings themselves, the lines of the drawings, if you look at them. I'm not so sure about the likeness of the 12th Doctor, which his hairdo changes frame to frame quite a lot. You know, it's combed back up at one point and it seems to be combed down at another.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure where the references have gone there. But
did you guys notice how tall Clara is?
There is one shot, isn't there, where there's two very tall people.
She's nearly, I don't know, like 7 feet tall. And in real, I believe she's 5'2".
She's my height.
Yeah, she's even standing further back than the Doctor in that particular picture I think you're talking about.
Pitch, Lex.
Oh, yeah. Well, it popped out at me immediately. I must be particularly sensitive to the heights of things, proportions. I was like, Claire is massive.
So the actual drawings and the artwork, I'll probably give a 7-2, but the colouring's quite beautiful.
Yeah.
It's got a nice turn across the whole of it, which is quite beautiful. That's Luis Guerrero, who's a Mexican chap, who's done the colouring. Hmm. So I'd actually give that a higher mark than the drawings.
Wow.
So I'm probably going with an 8 or... I'll go with an 8 for that. And the story itself, for me... Well, I'm quite impressed that they can compact a lot of stuff into such a short story, because it always amazed me that they can cram a whole episode into 45 minutes. So to actually be able to tell a nice little story in a few pages. I remember in the mid-1980s, there was you used to buy these crisps, Golden Wonder crisps, and in the multi-packs there used to be a mini Doctor Who comic.
Hmm.
And I was always amazed at how much they packed into the small space. Again, there was one of them about a sentient being as well, I'm thinking back. But yeah, so the actual story itself, I'll stop beating around the bush. I'll give that a 7 as well, I think.
Yeah, I liked the story a lot. I liked learning that quartz under pressure produces electricity. I had no idea.
Yeah, that was a good point.
Yeah, it was science-y. I didn't really understand what the doctor, like, his first few lines were complete, like, I don't know if they were nonsense, but what was he talking about? Making a transmitter radio out of bathroom sinks? Is that what, did you guys catch that? I mean, sometimes I just kind of skim over the stuff. If I don't understand it, I'll just move on. So maybe that's what you guys did, but now that I was reviewing it, I'm like, what? Yeah, what in the world?
I'm pretty sure he's talking about the way that he maybe makes things out of bits of junk.
Oh,
Is taps a British slang word?
Yeah, no, definitely. I believe it's what you'd know as a faucet. Is that correct?
Oh, okay.
Your taps are what you have on your sink. Yeah. You turn the tap on and you get your water. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're learning a lot today. I know that where he talks about the quartz with wraps around a copper core.
Mm-hmm.
Do know that you used to be able to get these things called crystal radio sets, where you had a crystal. I don't know if it was quartz or not, where you could make a radio or a transmitter.
Is that like a Tesla coil or something?
It could be. I know they used to sell these as kits to kids in the 1940s. Crystal radios. I don't know if he's sort of moving on from that, suggesting that maybe he went up a notch and started making components out of plumbing.
Yeah, it gives the storyline, the first few lines, a little bit more sense. It's putting stuff together.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, cool. Mm-hmm. Learned a lot.
So what scores...
I would probably give it a 7-2. There are other things that bothered me, like the baddie, Luther. I mean, can we call him a baddie? I think we can, right? The guy...
The mustache guy?
The mustache guy.
He was a bit slimy, definitely.
Yeah, he, like, the doctor refers to him as an alpha personality. Presumably, I mean, he is a leader of sorts among these people that are taking advantage of this planet. But every slide that they had of him, every image, was him in this, like, shrug position, even when he wasn't talking, which I found not alpha at all. That just suggests that he's, uncertain.
Yeah, he's got a lot of hand movement.
Yeah, hand movements. Like, it's not what an alpha personality does necessarily. I was taken aback by that. That bothered me. Okay, but I'm nitpicky. I don't know. I give it a 7-2. I think that's I don't know. Oh, all around. There were great things to it, but 7, I think.
And for me, yeah, I already wrote that down. The story, I gave it a 7.5. And the art, I liked it. I thought it was really sharp. I gave the art an 8.
I didn't give one for art. Is that okay? Just an all-around one?
Yeah, that's fine.
The art.
Thanks. I think I gave 2 for art, so you can have one a man.
There you go. Thank you. I'll take that.
Okay, shall we move on to 11th Doctor?
Okay.
All right, take it away, Lex.
So the 11th story, what was that called? It was Give Free or Die or something, right? Is that what it's called? Give Free or Die? Yeah.
Give free or die.
Give free or die. Nice plagiarism. It's this. The story is about some sentient. Well, at the beginning, it wasn't a being. It was just kind of a sentience. It was a psychic energy of sorts that had somehow manifested and, well, taken over all the literature on the planet throughout time. It suggested that it was actually traveling through time. They had some, the doctor was reading a line that was from the go-between. The past is a different country. Zagnar does things there and here and anywhere he pleases. Scum. Oh, the doctor says scum, not Zagnar. So yeah, that's a basic summary of what Zagnar does. He takes over the world through literature, which also creates sort of a meta storyline overall of Free Comic Book Day.
Yes, I love that.
It was mighty hilarious. This story was excellent. So I'm going to give it a really high rating for that. Yeah, I loved it. What else should I say?
Oh, what about Arc?
Yeah, Arc. Yep. Arc frequently saves the day. He sort of he functions as an R2-D2 kind of character throughout the issues. He's great. He's adorable, but very powerful. And yeah, frequently saves the day, like in this issue. Apparently vomit saved the day. You can take Arc's vomit and turn it into a sentient being. Not the prettiest creature I've ever seen on Doctor Who, that's for sure. It's sort of this pimply, poopy thing with arms. Tentacles. I don't. Yeah, is that how you describe it?
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's adorable, actually, but gross looking.
Yeah,
and I guess represents the psyche of writers. The writers of this comic were very humble, or is that the appropriate word? Self demeaning.
Yeah.
It was. I loved it.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Yeah. I don't know. What am I missing, guys?
This is pretty good to me.
Yeah. It is a good one. Yeah. The thing about this writing team is that they like to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And do put a lot of fun stuff in the 11th Doctor stories. And yeah. Again, Simon Fraser's done the artwork for this, and he works really well with that team. And yeah, they are. It's just a fun little romp. I really like this one. And it's so clever just turning the whole Free Comic Book Day thing on its head. You know, you actually feel part of the story, and it doesn't make you start questioning what you're reading.
Yeah.
I like, just as a side point, that first frame, is that supposed to be Piccadilly Circus?
Yep.
It is, yes.
I was just, the billboards were kind of cracking me up, like...
Yeah.
Call your mother.
Yeah, call your mother. So
the birds.
Yeah, the birds, the musical.
Yeah, there's so much I love about the 11th Doctor comic series that they've been doing. The characters, have you guys been reading the 11 comic? I don't know.
I've read a couple.
A couple?
Yeah, I'm only at the start of the 11th Doctor ones.
Okay. But the Jones character, it's so great that they put him in there. He's David Bowie.
Yeah.
But I guess, I don't know if they're allowed to directly say it, like, bluntly. This is David Bowie.
He's implied.
Oh, it's definitely highly, heavily implied. He's an interesting character. They kind of use him like... It occurred to me a couple days ago. He's just like Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. He's got the same humor, but a lot more flair.
Arc Scooby-Doo?
Oh my god! What? Yeah.
That's going to really, really change the way I read the voices in my head now.
Oh, jeez.
And then who's the girl then? Is that one of... There's two girls in Scooby-Doo.
Clearly. She's wearing purple, so she must be Daphne.
Oh, there you go. Oh,
all right, Daphne. She's a lot smarter than Daphne, though.
Yeah. All right. Oh, well. Ooh, Velma coming in there as well, then.
So is
a combination.
Question for you, Lex. Is this the same artist that has been doing the 11th Doctor?
I don't know.
It is, yes.
Oh, okay.
Simon Fraser. Yeah.
What do you think of this art style?
Generally, pretty good. I mean, the Matt Smith is really hard to draw.
Yeah, I was noticing that.
I mean, every artist that I've ever heard talking, I mean, yeah.
He's hard to draw. Do you guys watch Star Trek?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he reminds me of, like, a changeling, Matt Smith. Like, he's got, like those weird kind of facial features.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, that actually reminds me, though, speaking of Star Trek, this story, do you know the episode The Game? The Next Generation episode?
What happens in it?
They all get addicted to this, like, headset game thing.
Yeah, I remember that, one. Yeah,
this
yeah.
reminded me of that a little bit. Like, everyone's just, yeah, some...
Well, it's the first Sarah Jane adventure as well, wasn't it? The invasion of the Bane, where everyone's addicted to the same drink.
You guys covered up pretty much what I was thinking. Like, I really liked the story just because it was so clever and meta, like you said.
Yeah. Oh, I have to give a shout out to one line. They're always putting in the best lines for the Doctor. They really do capture his personality. One of his first interactions with the screaming customers for the comics, he goes up to this, like, taps on the shoulder of this gray-haired, like, bespectacled, spectacles, glasses, man who's walking across the street saying, "Excuse me, young man." This old, old feller.
That's awesome.
It's so the Doctor, yeah. I love that. Okay, I'm done. That was the one shout out.
So, yeah, for the art, for me, like, I thought it was a really interesting art style, but, like, you were, like, yeah, the likeness isn't really there with the Doctor. I'd probably have to give the art a 7.
A 7? Yeah. Yeah, a 7. But I would go for a 9 overall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, really high. I'd love to.
Yeah, that was, I think that was my favorite story, even over the 10th Doctor one.
Yeah, my favorite story as well. I'm probably going to score the artwork higher because one of the things I do actually like a comic book style artwork rather than a photoreal style artwork.
Oh, gotcha.
And I know that Simon Fraser is what he tries to do. He's given up trying to basically capture a likeness of Matt Smith and has created his own version of Matt Smith.
Right.
So that at least he's got continuity in his own world of what Matt Smith looks like.
Sort of like the Princess Leia one, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So he's trying to capture the essence. I think once you get past that, and I just like the block colours rather than a lot of shading, I just quite like that style. Yeah, it's nice to see an old-fashioned comic style.
Yeah.
He's very good at buildings. I think it's very strangely deserted. I'd go a 9 on the whole look of the artwork, and I'll go an 8 on the story.
Cool. Good. We have variety. And I like that viewpoint. I'm always curious about what the artist's intentions are. I haven't gotten around to researching them fully, so I love hearing that. Thanks.
Cool.
Your time, Kate.
Okay, so 10th Doctor. So did you guys think that was interesting how they did it 12th, 11th, 10th, like in that order?
Yeah.
Like, I think it would have almost made more sense to do it 10th, 11th, 12th. Anyway.
I think they might have done that on purpose.
Yeah, I was wondering if the thing about the 12th Doctor stories is I think they found them quite difficult because he's the Doctor now.
Yeah.
So there isn't a bookend of to how the character will eventually be.
Yeah.
With 10 and 11, you've got that bookend, so they can play with them a lot better in the stories. Whereas the 12th Doctor is sometimes it's a bit hit and miss.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're really, really pushing it a lot because he's the current Doctor, and that's probably where the BBC's money is and what they really want advertising.
That's
true. You can keep the other Doctors, but we've got to really push the 12th because he's the one the kids know.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And, like, on the inside cover page, how he's definitely prominent.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
That explains a lot. So his stories are sort of limited. I mean, yeah, I think they put him in this order because in terms of the reader's enjoyment, you want to sort of, like, build it up slow, have a really awesome story, and then have a really solid story to end with all of it. I think they arced it sort of in that way, or it worked out that way anyway, so 12th Doctor going first makes sense in terms of the effect the storyline has on the reader, mm-hmm. and, like, excitement level and all that.
Cool.
Yeah, that's my theory.
Okay, so let's get on to the overview of the 10th Doctor story. So the little description, it says, chaos strikes when the Doctor and Gabriella Gonzalez attempt to do laundry aboard the TARDIS. So, like, just on the surface, like, it seems like a really mundane story, doesn't it?
Nonsense. The best ones are,
I know, right?
Like the everyday things.
Okay, so basically this story, Gabby and the Doctor, they come off of this planet that is just crazy muddy, and they're, like, all dirty and dripping with mud. And so the Doctor is going to show her the TARDIS laundry room. And her backstory is kind of like her dad owns a laundromat in New York City.
So kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't realize.
No, I'm not kidding.
I hadn't been reading comics. That is so appropriate.
I know. So, yeah, I really like Gabby. So, you know, she's, like, not easily oppressed when it comes to laundry since, you know, she's grown up around this her whole life. But it turns out that in the TARDIS, the washing machine can do amazing things. Like, it actually, like, deconstructs the stuff and gets all the dirt out, and it repurposes the dirt and, like, all this crazy stuff. And so she's like, okay, that's pretty impressive. But then I forget what actually happened, but the dirt becomes sentient, kind of similar.
The Doctor leaves his sonic in the washing machine.
Oh,
he's left it in his pocket, hasn't he? So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so...
And the TARDIS, you know, it just kind of... There's all this psychic energy floating in it anyways.
Exactly.
Mm.
So, yeah. So there's, like, this big, huge dirt blob thing that's, like, sentient, caused by the sonic screwdriver. Yeah.
It wasn't menacing.
Yeah, it wasn't menacing. And so, basically... It gives the sonic screwdriver back to him, and then everything goes back to normal.
Well, maybe I gave you the wrong word. It is menacing, but at its heart isn't menacing.
Yeah.
It's very, hard. Going back, it is very much a Scooby-Doo monster, isn't it, that one?
That's true.
Oh, yes, yeah. It is. Yeah, yeah. Excellent point. There's a Scooby-Doo thing in as well.
So, yeah, it hands the sonic screwdriver back to the Doctor, and I guess that... basically makes it go back to being just dirt, right?
Yeah, it's not really, they don't really tell you what happens to the dirt monster afterwards. Maybe he just hangs out in the TARDIS from then on, kind of chills out.
I guess it just goes back to being dirt then?
Yeah.
Because he said that it was, like, repurposed. But anyway, so then, you know, the final scene is they get their clothes out of the washing machine, and he's got flowers on his shirt, and she's got this bit. Pinstripes on her shirt, and she's like, pinstripes aren't really my thing. So I thought that was a good end.
Yeah, I laughed out loud. That was good.
So, yeah, I like this one. Although I didn't like the story as much as the 11th Doctor, but I would give the story, like, a 9. I liked it a lot. I would give the 10th, or, yeah, the 11th Doctor, like, a 9.5, probably. I don't know if I said that or not. But The artwork, I like the art style, and I just got the issue for the next 10th Doctor issue. It's the same artist, and actually, I like it. I'm really liking this artist a lot.
Yeah, it's got a sort of manga-ish hint to it, hasn't it?
Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah, so the art style is really cool. Yeah, I think I'd give the art, like, a 8.5.
I can't remember what I scored other things now.
Well, what did you say, Andy?
I said I can't remember what I'd scored the other things, but this, I mean, the good thing about this story, again, is I like the fact that it's a TARDIS set story. I always love a story set inside the TARDIS. Oh, I'll let you say it then.
Oh, yeah.
Go on.
I really liked how it was in the TARDIS.
Yay!
I do as well. They're my favorite. They're my favorite moments when you get to see more about the TARDIS.
Yeah, so you get to see, like, the wardrobe. Like, that's crazy. That's really cool how the big spiral staircase and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Mm. Is it what you expected, guys?
Inside the TARDIS, you mean?
What the wardrobe looks like.
Oh, it's pretty cool.
Yeah?
I wouldn't mind looking through there for some clothes.
Well, I mean, you see, we've seen a little bit of it in the Christmas Invasion, didn't we, with the spiral staircase and stuff, but this really expands it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I just love the way the stuff thrown about. This is the kind of thing, as if you get a magnifying glass out, it's seeing what the artist sneaked in.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's probably an Indiana Jones costume or a Batman suit sneaked in there somewhere, because they like playing little tricks like that.
Did you like the nod to Classico?
With the boot cupboard.
I thought the coloring of the wardrobe was very muddy, and that was probably intentional, considering this is about a muddy beast of sorts. It was a lot of brown in the wardrobe.
Right.
Mm.
Oh, interesting.
Lots of browns. Maybe they knew it was going to be about mud, so they loaded up with the
wears
brown.
He wears like the brown trench coat and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely.
He needs a lot of brown trench coats, you're saying? The tents are?
Definitely.
Everybody.
I think they've taken a nice little Stephen Moffat motif as well, in that he takes the mundane and everyday and makes it terrifying. And now the Doctor could very well have had a very space-age washing machine, and although it's got a little bit of exciting design to it, it is a front-loading washing machine like everyone's probably got in their house.
Yeah.
You know, with the basket next to it and the shelves with the folded towels and things. So now, you know, it's the kind of things that where kids are going to freak out now going to open the washing machine because a big mud monster's going to come out.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think it's covered. I mean, the other thing that, so the artwork is really nice to just pick it up on where you've got the sound effects of the dirt monster, where you get the sound effects, the splats and the splurps.
They've
been coloured so there's a little bit of white shininess left on the lettering, so it's got that sort of blobby look to it as well. You know, even the, you know, it's very well done, very nice.
Yeah, cool. Splitch and slatch. Oh, splatch.
Yeah.
Interesting. So that's what mud sounds like.
Exactly.
Splatch.
So what score would you guys give the overall Free Comic Book Day Doctor Who issue?
For the 10th Doctor, I haven't given a rating.
Oh, go ahead and do the 10th Doctor.
I would give...
Go ahead and give your scores for the 10th Doctor, guys.
Yeah, an 8 for the 10th Doctor, like, overall story. And for the colorings and the drawings, I give it a 9, I think. I was a fan of this one. This is my favorite in the book. So what we're going to give the sonic screwdrivers of the entire thing.
Well, I haven't marked that one yet either. The 10th, have I?
You haven't done it either, right?
No. I agree on a 9 on the artwork. The story, when I read the story, I couldn't get the 11th Doctor's voice out of my head when I was reading it.
Hmm.
I don't know if it's because I enjoyed the 11th Doctor story so much, maybe. I did try going back and doing it in David Tennant's voice, but it wasn't doing it for me.
You mentioned that. I had the same problem too, actually, especially when you said, like, good as new. Like, I heard the 11th Doctor in my head. For some reason, the 10th Doctor wouldn't say good as new.
No,
I don't know. Yeah.
I'll go a 7 for the story on that one.
Mm. Okay, so for the entire issue, what score would you give it?
Well, it was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun and free, let's not forget.
Exactly.
Free.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking like a 10 because it's like free Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Free sonic screwdrivers for free comic books. 10 out of 10s.
Yay.
Yeah. I don't think the order of it's possibly wrong.
Uh-huh.
As we've already said, but I'm not going to hold that against it because, it's free and it was fun.
Yeah.
You know, three doctors, three stories, lots of different artists and writers, you know, and it's a good taste of what the actual comics are like, so.
That's cool.
Good on them, yeah.
So, yeah, that's cool.
Roll on 10.
Roll on 10.
Yeah, 10 for the whole thing, yeah.
So, did you guys see it at the end about the special issue, or is it it's a series of issues, right, coming out in August?
I guess
we'll have to definitely
5 issues,
we'll have to reconvene for that, right, guys?
Absolutely.
Definitely, yeah.
That's gonna be so cool with the three doctors,
the 12th doctor finally interacting with the other guys.
So
it's in Paris.
Oh yeah, that's true, it's in Paris.
Oh yeah, they're returning to Paris, aren't they? Yeah.
So yeah, we'll definitely have to get together again for that.
Lovely speaking to you both, and can't wait to do it again in a couple, two months.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
that was good
fun. Awesome.
We're not all going home in the same TARDIS, are we?
Certainly not. I will take
Okay.
Yeah, we each take our own doctor's TARDIS.
Ah, right, okay. Marvelous.
No, nothing. I was just going to have my own tag phrase. Come along, 11th.
Nice. Yeah, take care, guys. It was a lot of fun talking to you.
Fantastic.
Yeah. All right. Allons-y, and may the force be with you.
Allons-y.
Please, sir, if you don't mind. The game's already started. His lordship won the toss and decided to bat first to give you time to get here. That train's always late.
That's very thoughtful of his lordship.
Yes, sir. But I do think we should hurry. His lordship is a first-class bat, but I'm not quite sure how strong his support is this year.
In a recent 42 to Doomsday, a Doctor Who podcast I quite enjoy, which also comes out of Australia, they discuss the Fifth Doctor era. It was a really good episode, yet because the show was more about the Fifth Doctor's stories than anything else, one element that did get glossed over was the Fifth Doctor's costume. Now, I wrote a piece years ago on the Fifth Doctor's costume, so inspired by this episode from my podcasting countrymen, I thought I'd dust it off and present it here with a bunch of new thoughts and in an audio-friendly format. I hope you like it.
Well, you better pad up, Doctor. Got your gear?
I regret I have none.
No matter, I'll fix you up. I'm taking a terrible thrashing, 54 for 8. I made a duck.
If you grew up with Doctor Who in the 1980s, and especially if, like me, Peter Davison is your Doctor, you have heard a million times that he, allegedly, wore the clothes of an Edwardian cricketer. Now, this wasn't just in episodes like Black Orchid, which is where I'm pulling these sound clips from, and where the Doctor actually plays cricket, but throughout his whole era. And for a reference point to listeners unfamiliar with the term, Edwardian is generally taken to be about 1901, after the death of Queen Victoria, through to about 1910, sometimes up to the start of the Great War itself. So basically, men who are out of Victorian-looking garb, but not quite modern yet. But here's the thing. Did he? Did the Fifth Doctor really rock the clothes of an Edwardian cricketer? You see, outside of this podcast, in what I like to call the real world, I'm what often gets called a cricketing tragic. For those not familiar with the term, perhaps think something along the lines of enthusiast or aficionado or, shudder, fanboy. And I have a lot of cricket reference material here in my study. Maybe too much. Yet, in not one single reference book have I ever seen a cricketer in red and white striped pants, or blue and white striped pants, or green and white striped pants, or striped pants in general. Not in photos, not in drawings, not in museums I've been to, not in historical reenactments. Nowhere. The closest I've ever got to a hit was in an old black and white image of UK schoolboys who were in shorts. And the caption referred to those shorts as striped. But the image was so bad, they just looked like a single colour. That's the closest I've ever got. So, those pyjama pants Davison wears with the subtle stripes for his first couple of seasons, then the obnoxious, hey, look at me, I'm wearing striped pants version for his final season, yeah, they're not really cricketing attire. Perhaps someone, somewhere, once wore their pyjamas by accident to a game? Maybe? We're really clutching at straws when not one example can be dug up, and even if one was, it would still remain a very, very, very extraordinarily uncommon look for an Edwardian cricketer, or indeed a cricketer from any era. I mean, please, go digging as much as you like, and you will find cream or white trousers are the order of the day.
Smarty said he'd sent a useful bat.
Smarty?
Smarty Thomas. Oh, didn't you call him Smarty at guys?
No, as a matter of fact.
Oh, well, Smarty at school. Now, the wicket's very green, the ball's keeping low. Any good with the ball?
Not bad.
Good. Medium pace, slow?
Fast.
Top hoe.
All right then, Smarty Pants Rob, so what about the frock coat? That's got to be correct, surely. Well, while you can find people wearing frock coats in several eras across the 19th and 20th century, they were certainly less common in the Edwardian era. They're probably more of an artifact of the Victorian era when you think about it. And they particularly didn't look as odd as the Fifth Doctor's. Cricketers in the Edwardian era, as now, would have almost always worn a blazer. I'm sure you know what a blazer is, but for the sake of being clear about the styling, it's more akin to a modern sports coat or a suit jacket. Now, these might have been striped. Think of Ford Prefect in the 1980s TV series of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Or they might have been a single colour. Black and dark blue are popular colours for cricket clubs, often with some kind of piping, like the Fifth Doctor's outfit, but certainly not in a knee-length sort of format. So, with the coat and trousers being absolute bobbins in terms of what an Edwardian cricketer would have worn, what did the costume actually get right? Well, the boots aren't too bad in general, although they do have a very, very modern sole. You sometimes see it in publicity shots where Pete's got his legs up in the air for whatever reason. Of course, that's just a practical thing. Could you imagine wearing spikes on the studio floor? And the jumper is pretty good too, although it's not quite right. It's an approximation of a cricket jumper, and it does the job. To throw in an accessory, the Panama hat's not too bad for the period either. I guess the question I ask myself the most about the Fifth Doctor's costume is why, after hitting on the right era for the youthful Fifth Doctor, because let's face it, that romantic era just before the world plunged into the horror of the Great War suits Davison's younger look and his attitude, very importantly, to a T. After choosing that, they then veered off into clothes that are basically a parody of what real clothes from the era were actually like, and to be honest, often aren't really seen in that era at all. Now, some say it was the desire of producer John Nathan Turner to give the Doctors a more uniform look, which would be distinctive and perhaps marketable. Although, when you think of Doctor Who merchandise back then, as being some Target novels, a poster, and maybe a badge if you were lucky, what was marketing supposed to be about then anyway? But, you know, let's put that aside. In terms of this theory, just think of the way JNT took Tom Baker's costume, which had always been gloriously bohemian with a little change here and there between shows, you know, between waistcoats and cardigans and shoes and boots and short jackets and long jackets, and he replaced it with that uniform-looking maroon costume of season 18 where everything matched. It was almost a parody of Tom's old costume. It was like the style of his old costume, but everything was maroon and I guess a shade of dark brown or something, perhaps. And then you arrive at the subject of today's feature, where everything looks really put together and not like real clothing at all, through to the abomination of Colin Baker's costume, and then on to Sylvester McCoy, who, in fairness, was getting back to a more loose, bohemian kind of look with his two-tone shoes and baggy check pants evoking the Second Doctor or perhaps a mad golfer, his little short jacket and a straw hat, if only he'd ditched that awful question mark vest. But anyway, back to Davison.
Doctor substitute has made your score almost respectable, Charles.
Perfectly ripping performance. Much better player than Smutty.
How would I have dressed the Fifth Doctor? Well, like I said earlier, I think the pre-Great War look is just right for the young Davison. Perhaps to some degree this was inspired by Davison's turn in All Creatures Great and Small. Now, admittedly, that was the 1930s leading into the Second World War, but it still had a similar vibe in some ways to 20 years earlier, and perhaps where the idea to go to for that look came from. Who knows? A better Edwardian look for Davison, even keeping the cricket motif to some degree, would have been something like beige trousers, you know, a little baggy, a crisp white shirt without those ridiculous question marks, thank you very much, a cricket jumper, and, you know, this is the big one, a striped blazer, like we're talking about earlier. Not a frock coat, a blazer, with stripes. I mentioned Ford Prefect in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy TV series earlier, and there's a great example of a striped blazer. But there are so many variations out there. Google something like striped cricket blazer and tell me any of the hits you get wouldn't have been a more quirky and less uniform-looking or costume-looking look than the Fifth Doctor's frock coat that we know and not all of us love. And you know what else? If the cricket jumper and striped cricket blazer shouted too much cricket, I'd lose the cricket jumper altogether and go with something like the beautiful waistcoat that the Fifth Doctor inexplicably puts on in Planet of Fire. Where on earth did that come from? It looks fantastic. And it doesn't match his costume. If Davison had a little more chaos in his costume while keeping that Edwardian theme... Well, I think you understand my point by now. And then there's the celery. To this day, I really can't decide if it was quirky, inspired British eccentricity, or just a last-minute realisation that the bland beige coat and pyjama pants that looked like nothing from the era suddenly needed something to say, hey, check it out, I'm still that wacky old doctor. Who knows, eh? Who knows? All in all, it might seem strange to make a small feature about this topic, given that Davison's costume has come and gone, and there's not even a whiff of any sort of revisionist version of it. Think of the Colin Baker costume on the cover of some Big Finish audios done in all blue tones, for example. But, you see, Davison is my doctor, and cricket is one of my top two sports. Given that, I just wish they'd done the look better and more authentically for both cricket and the era they were evoking in general. He could have looked great in a costume which, even today, wouldn't have dated because, surprise, it would have been authentic to an actual era. With the weird uniform-like costume he was given, when you see the Fifth Doctor now standing alongside, say, the new Who Doctors, the look is like someone who's just stepped off a pantomime stage. Which, I suppose, given JNT's involvement, isn't that unusual. Anyway, what do you think of the Fifth Doctor's look? Do you like it? Do you hate it? How would you have done it? Send us an email to hello@whowars.net or make an MP3 for us and we'll use it on the show. Oh, and by the way, if anyone out there can send me an image of Edwardian cricketers in striped trousers and or with long Victorian frock coats instead of the traditional striped blazer of that era, I would genuinely like to see it.
Performance, old boy. Come over to the house and meet the Major.
I've never recorded an interview this close to midnight, so anything could happen. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a night owl.
Well, this is probably down to DJ attendances and things.
Yeah, that's, you know, yeah, I think that's what it
exactly.
Is. Yeah. Yeah.
He's the kind of guy who wears sunglasses inside, I could tell. Very excited to be joined tonight by someone who's brought pleasure to our ears over the years. It is Dominic Glynn, Doctor Who composer, among other things. Good evening.
Good evening, Andy. Nice to speak to you.
Right, so people know exactly who you are, I'm going to jump in with something which I think is an amazing claim to fame. You are one of a select few who got to arrange the Doctor Who theme tune.
Yeah, there weren't really that many of us, were there? That's right, I was really, really lucky to get that gig, and it wasn't one that I was looking for, if you know what I mean. I wasn't seeking that job out, it came to me, that one. I did sort of push myself forward to get the work writing incidental music for Doctor Who, and in the 80s I was a struggling musician playing keyboards in a band, and I wanted to make a career out of making music, and I just knew as a synthesizer player, electronics guy, that the openings for music with the synthesizer were relatively limited But Doctor Who was a fantastic, you know, opportunity for somebody who could write electronic music. So I just pestered the producer and sent him cassettes and demo tapes and letters. And he was really open to listening to new ideas from people.
This is John Nathan Turner, of
course. That's right, John Nathan Turner. Unfortunately, John Nathan Turner, obviously, at that point, had been thinking about the music and the direction he was going with the music in the show, and he decided to give me a chance. So he offered me the work writing incidental music first, and it was only after I hadn't even started, to be honest, that he rang up and said, oh, would you also like to have a go at redoing the theme music? So it was totally unexpected.
It's an amazing offer. I do love your version of the theme tune.
Oh, thank you. Well, a lot of people don't, you know.
I'm very aware of that, which is really interesting. But I remember when I got on cassette the 25th anniversary album, your version of the theme was one that I really loved.
Oh, that's and good.
The reason is because it has an eeriness to it.
Yeah, well, I was aiming for that. I was trying to do that, so I'm glad you picked up on that.
And the other thing that also, if people want to have a re-listen to this and just have a think about it, as far as I'm aware, in the original run of the series, you were the only composer who added your own element to the melody.
Yeah.
Which was the bit that played into the beginning of the episode, the sort of... musical, which, again, was every version of the theme tune now has a little augmented bit. So, I think that's why it stands out for me.
Oh, well, that's good to know. I mean, it's funny because people really, genuinely, they either love it or they hate it. And it doesn't seem to stir much middle ground. It's on either side of the spectrum. And lots of people really, you know, it's their least favourite. And other people say, oh, yeah, and apart from the original, it's their absolute favourite. Or, you know, it stirs up different emotions in people.
When people hear synthesizer music a lot, all they will do is think, oh, synth, the 80s.
Yeah.
They don't actually listen to the sounds that the synth is producing and the sort of moods and, you know, the textures it's putting down. So, I think, you know, it's well worth a listen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
So, you've talked a bit there about pandering to John Nathan Turner and, you know, sending him demos and things.
Yeah.
At the time, what was the process of writing a score for a Doctor Who story?
Well, very antiquated. When I look at it now and think about the methods that we used, it was so primitive. Although, having said that, nowhere near as primitive as it was even 10, 15 years prior to when I started working on it. But it was very manual. There was nothing automated when I was starting on the show. Because I was an independent composer, freelancer, working at home, relatively young, I was 24, 25, I hadn't got much equipment, I hadn't got a lot of money, I was basically doing it on the cheap to start with, and sort of blagging my way into this, really. So I had limited equipment, and I didn't have any of this newfangled MIDI, which was the interface for connecting equipment together, and I certainly didn't have any kind of synchronization, no computers, I didn't have any samplers to start with. So in the very, very beginning of my work on Doctor Who in 1986, I was recording to tape, reel-to-reel tape machine. I was playing everything in by hand on the keyboard, and I was synchronizing everything simply by watching the video on my VHS tape machine and pressing play on the tape recorder when I needed to, you know, match up something in time. So it was literally a load of the time was spent trying to match things up, synchronizing things, and, as I say, completely manually.
How closely would you work with the author of the story or the director in order to make sure the same emotions were being put across?
Depended on the story. I worked mostly with the director. That was kind of crucial. I mean, I understand it doesn't really work like that now with Doctor Who, but in those days, the composer and the director were in contact all the time, and you know, you'd go through each episode and spot the episode with the director, so he would sit there and you know, make suggestions of where he wanted the music to be, and I would make suggestions of where I wanted to put music, and we'd discuss whether maybe something would work better with or without music, and where the sound effects were going to go. So Dick Mills from the Radiophonic Workshop would be putting in his ideas and all that sort of stuff. So that would happen. Depending on the story, yeah, I'd normally talk to the writer as well. I never talked, sadly, to Robert Holmes, who did the first stuff I did on Doctor Who. He was apparently very ill at the time, and so he never came in, or, you know, I never had any contact with him, which was a shame. But on all the other stories, I, you know, got to know the writers well, and, you know, we had informal chats about it rather than anything formal, because, as I say, the formal conversations were always with the director, but informally, I always spoke to the writers and, you know, talked it through.
Was there any definite no-nos when composing music for Doctor Who? Was there an overall template of how it should work, as there was a number of composers on the... Sure.
Well, there probably was, but it was never actually sort of quantified or written down. I think it just came about from, you know, knowing the programme. I knew the show and I kind of knew what would work in it. You know, I had a clear idea in my head of how I wanted to do it. I was never given any sort of instructions, if you know what I mean. It was all pretty much, you know, do what you feel is right. And then obviously in conjunction with the director of each story, talking about a style that I'd find for each story. There wasn't really... I mean, that was the great thing as well about Doctor Who in those days, is each story, the music was tailor-made to that story, very much so. So the score to one story might be entirely different from the score to another story. And, you know, because Doctor Who... As a show is, you know, so different from episode to episode, the fact that you've got a historical story followed by a space epic, followed by something set on Earth in the, you know, contemporary world or whatever, you know, everything's different. And it gave great scope for the composer to do different things with the score.
Do you think that that makes the job these days difficult, as they've had the single composer for 10 years now in Murray Gold?
I don't know. Is it more difficult? It's probably a mixed bag, because in many ways he's found a formula that works, and he can repeat the formula and do things that he's done before because it works. But I suppose the downside for him must be that, you know, it's an awful lot of music to do, and to keep it sounding fresh must be quite hard for him as well.
So generally, do you think the way music works in TV has changed over the years?
Yeah, I mean, it's got much closer to film music now, and in many ways that's kind of what I wanted to do with Doctor Who, in the sense that I wanted its soundtrack to be more cinematic. And I think that has happened with TV generally. There used to be a real clear boundary between what was TV music and what was film music. And as I've often said to people, if you listen to Doctor Who music from, say, the early 80s, it's very difficult to imagine that ever having worked in a film score. You know, just it would have sort of jarred in the setting of a movie. And so when I started working on the show, I kind of wanted to sort of make the music sound more cinematic. And I think that's definitely now, as we got into, you know, the 2010s, that is what TV music tends to sound like now. You couldn't necessarily tell the difference between a TV score and a film score.
Now, Doctor Who was very early on in your incidental career, wasn't it?
Well, it was my first proper paid job as a musician, yeah.
Which is quite exciting, because then you've gone on to do lots of other things. Now, a trip to your website will tell people lots of the TV shows and programmes you've been involved with that will bring back lots of memories and come bang up to date. Something I was interested in, though, on your website, and this is the documentary Dangerous Game.
All right, yeah.
Trump, he put up a fence. The police were there when he put it up, and they said, if I touch that fence, I will be charged.
Nowadays, it's a game of the moneyed.
Trump out!
He carted. Oh, it must have been thousands and thousands of dumper loads to build the mounds in front of the Monroes.
There's lots of Donald Trumps out there. There's people like him in every country and in every community.
Stop filming.
He either leaves the land on search, or they will kill me.
It's a follow-on to a documentary which people may have seen, which was about Donald Trump buying up land in Scotland to build a golf course, which meant evicting people. The reason I'm bringing this up and why I was talking about immersion in fantasy programmes and films and things, because this is a very different kind of project. And how do you put across these feelings in immersion?
It's a good question, really. I mean, in many ways, particularly with a film like A Dangerous Game, you are, as you say, dealing with real people who are going through a difficult issue in their life. And some people are having a real problem, and it's affecting their lives. And the thing is, you almost have to pull back from being too in tune with their emotions, because you don't want the film to end up being almost like over-egging the pudding. Is that the expression? You know, where you literally are scraping on the emotion, because that, you know, you're overdoing it. Then the story itself can tell you that there's an emotional issue. If you overdo it with the music, it just sort of it spoils it. So I don't find the difficult bit isn't actually managing to empathise with the people in the film or the situation or whatever it is. It's holding back from overdoing it, which in some ways is the harder task.
Whenever a TV company wants to do a James Bond, for instance,
yeah,
but can't afford to pay for the music, there's always a bit of music on that sounds a bit like James Bond. You've done some of those tunes.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
I think they're real good fun. Are they good fun too?
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't done them for years. They used to get people to do that sort of thing a lot more than they do now. I mean, when I first started writing this, what a lot of my work now is called production music, library music, what people sometimes call stock music, as it used to be known in the 60s. And they used to do that a lot, do music a bit like James Bond, like you say. And yeah, it was great fun. I mean, I did the very first project I did for the library music company I worked for was film themes, you know, sounding like film themes. And yeah, it was hilarious, actually, at points where you realise, no, hang on, you can't do that because that's way too close to the original. So you have to draw a careful line between, you know, a Good Morning Judge and, you know, people not knowing what you're trying to pastiche.
I do very much like the thunder, the sounds like Thunderbirds one.
That's right, yeah. Funnily enough, there was also a Sounds Like Doctor Who, which was one of the first things I got asked to do.
But yeah,
sure, that's why I got the job, but that's certainly was one of the first things they asked me to do, yeah.
I'm going to smoothly segue here, because we mentioned judges and copyright there, which might come up in this next story, but can you tell everybody who the Slaves of Cain are?
Well, the Slaves of Cain are me and a guy called Martin Smith, who I've co-written a lot of music with over the years. And that was an odd project. This is the Absalon Dark Dalek Killer single, which I think came out about 1989, 1990. And, yeah, how did that come about? Somebody just asked me to do it. They wanted to put out, originally, a track for the cover of Doctor Who magazine.
Yeah, I think it came as a flexi disc.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And, with people who have record players as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And, and obviously the Absalon Dark Dalek Killer, for those who don't know, was a comic strip, you know, featuring the Daleks, and not Doctor Who, but the Daleks. And somebody had the bright idea of turning it into a record, and then they realised they actually needed a musician to make the record. So somebody approached me, and I went for it. And I think Nick Briggs did the Dalek voices. So he's been doing them for years, and that was probably one of his first, you know, attempts at doing Dalek voices, because it was, as I say, it was late 80s, maybe 1990, probably somebody knows more than me when it was. Yeah, it's a slightly odd record, because it's kind of got a riff from the Stranglers in it as well, so people who know the record will know that it's kind of...
Is it Peaches?
Yeah, Peaches by the Stranglers, and people said, why has it got that? And I was desperate to make it not anything too horribly cheesy, because I knew that there are TV spin-offs of popular TV shows could sometimes be horribly cheesy, so I thought, let's try and make it a little bit gritty. So it just seemed to work well with that riff, so yeah, we went for it, which is why, if you look at it, it's actually credited as being by... I think it's credited as being by me and the Stranglers, which is really weird.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So that might end up on one of their greatest hits. One day. You never know.
Yeah.
Some of your Doctor Who scores, some of little extracts of them do actually end up being the most played clips of classic Doctor Who. We've got the opening of the Trial of the Time Lord.
Yeah.
Where the TARDIS is getting sucked into the Time Lord's ship.
Tell people that that was the most expensive shot that they'd ever done in Doctor Who, and I believe it was up to that point. And they'd spent all the budget on the whole season on that model shot. But it's also the very first piece of music that I wrote for Doctor Who, because that was the piece that got me the job. I wrote it originally as a demo when John Nathan Turner sent me the script of the beginning of that episode. And so I wrote that piece of music as my sort of demo audition piece for the job.
That's great. So they always show that clip when they're talking about when they're discussing budgets normally, I believe, and proving that Doctor Who was still fantastic. We have got the Happiness Patrol.
Yeah.
Am I right in thinking that this guy got a job on Doctor Who because he could play the harmonica, but he'd actually fibbed and he couldn't?
Yeah, it's very common, this. Happens all the time in film and TV. Actors get the part, and in the audition process, they're always asked, you know, can you ride a horse? Of course I can ride a horse. You know, can you play the harmonica? Yeah. But yes, he could blow into a harmonica, which produced a noise. But it wasn't really what you and I would call a harmonica player. So, but we didn't know that at the time. So I had to go and I'd written this music in advance because we knew that a lot of the music was going to be played by the actor on screen. So unusually, I'd written a lot of it in advance, which is not the normal way it worked. And I went round this guy's house, the actor who played Earl Sigma, armed with the music on a cassette and probably a keyboard or something to play it to him on. And it dawned on me within about 5 or 10 seconds that it was never going to work and that he couldn't play. And so I had to go away having a rethink about how we were going to do it. And they obviously couldn't change the actor. It's too late to, you know, get somebody else. And I had to get another harmonica player to play the harmonica parts, and when he was playing it, the timing was really bad on this. They were shooting, there was no time to fix this basically. So the harmonica player had to play on the day silently. The actor had to play silently. Richard D. Sharp, I think his name was. And then afterwards, when I was writing the score, I had to then get my harmonica player, who was a great blues player called Adam Burney. And I had to get him to play the music in afterwards, trying to match up with Richard's, you know, breath movements on screen and everything, so that it actually looked like he was playing it. But it was quite a difficult trick to pull off.
That's fantastic. So did you work often with the musicians then, bringing them into your score?
Well, given the chance, I always like to work with, you know, musicians when possible, because I felt it brought the score to life a bit. And I was just lucky that I had a couple of stories that, one that actually had to have a harmonica player in it, so that I was, you know, right from the word go,
I knew that I was going to be working with somebody who could play the blues, because it was important to the story. And again, we didn't want it to sound like cheesy, you know, cod blues. It had to sound genuine, and that was my aim all the way through it. It was going to sound like, you know, proper cool blues music and not something cheap and crappy. And then also with Survival, there was no guitar player in the story, but the director, Alan Waring, was quite determined that he wanted the music to have a flavour of a Dire Straits track, which he played to me and said, you know, when we get these vast, you know, landscapes of the alien planet, I can visualise this. And he played me this piece of music, and it was guitar, Dire Straits, and so I thought, okay, well, the best thing to do is to get a guitarist in. Mark Ayres tells me that John Nathan Turner was on holiday, and so he didn't get asked whether we could afford it in the budget. We just got him in, and I think it really helped with the story Survival to get this you know, feel to the music, which, you know, was really helped by the guitarist Dave Hardington.
The end of Survival is sort of what I want to talk about as well, because I'm aware that the scene at the end with the Doctor's speech was tagged on, and that Andrew Cartmell wrote the script for that. Was that still your composition that was going playing over that end?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't changed at the last minute or anything. I mean, it was worth noting that little speech that the Doctor makes at the end wasn't an afterthought or anything. It was shot on the day, and, you know, I've got the VHS tape that was filmed on location, and he makes the same speech. It just had to be re-recorded because there was an aeroplane going overhead, or there was too much noise or something, so it's not very clear. But it wasn't done later on. It was always in the script. Well, I say it was always in the script. It was added to the script, but before the last day of shooting. So it wasn't an absolute afterthought, and nobody knew that it was coming to an end either. So it wasn't added on by Andrew Cartmell because they knew it was coming to an end. It was just added on, I think, because... possibly because John thought there was a possibility that it might be the end, and he wanted it to go out with a nice, you know, a nice speech. But nobody knew for sure that it was going to be cancelled.
I think all too much in a lot of the documentaries that you see about Doctor Who, especially the ones that have been on television over the years, they do tend to scoot over the late 80s far too quickly.
Yeah.
They will start a section with the beginning of Mysterious Planet, and they will end the section with the speech from Survival. So
yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Key moments that are well known to Doctor Who fans.
That's really, yeah, I'm really lucky with that, yeah. But it's interesting because Survival, which obviously was the last story of Doctor Who for a long time, is definitely a taste of things to come for when it comes back. You know, lots of people have pointed out there are so many, you know, links between Survival and Rose. You know, there are, you know, stylistically speaking, it's in the same ballpark, basically.
Now, interestingly enough, at this sort of time in the late 80s, when sadly it was coming to an end on telly, and what was happening, because I was an avid reader of Doctor Who magazine, you'd start getting adverts in it for exciting pieces of merchandise. And one of the nicest things I remember sending off for was the 12-inch single Variations on a Theme. Now, you wrote on that the horror theme, which again gets mentioned quite a lot by excitable fans. I think every time there was a rumour that Doctor Who was going to come back as a gritty film and they're going to use this horror theme as the theme tune, it used to go around as a rumour, but it is a really fab piece of music, the horror theme.
Ah, thank you.
Do believe that there's a new version of the horror theme, if I'm not much mistaken, somewhere lurking around?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's it was called, originally it was on this Variations of a Theme, which was the three composers that worked on the show in the 80s, me, Mark Ayres and Keith McCulloch, all asked to contribute an alternative version of the Doctor Who theme, entirely different, we were asked to do. Yeah, and my version was called the Terror version, and it was, right. I think in the back of my mind, it probably was my demo for the film that never was. But again, it was my idea of making it more cinematic and, you know, doing that kind of bigger, more grand kind of feel to the music. And, but recently, I've remixed it, and it's coming out on an EP this month. The reason for that is I did an EP last year, or a mini album of remixes of the theme, the Doctor Who theme, which came about again because I went to the Gallifrey convention in Los Angeles and performed my theme live at the convention and did some remixes of it afterwards because people said, oh, could we buy it? And so I arranged to make these four versions of the theme available, and it did really well, the Gallifrey remixes. And then when I did some other conventions last year in America, I thought, okay, I'm going to extend this and do a bit more and work on some of the incidental music and stuff like that that I worked on the show. So the next thing that I did was this EP of remixes of some of the incidental music and also this Terror version of the Who theme. So they're all coming out. They're on an EP called the Ravelox Remixes, which should be available on iTunes and Amazon and any of those digital download sites from Monday the 18th.
Excellent. And what's it like revisiting old pieces? I mean, is it a strange feeling to go back and change them, or do you...
It's really nice to go back and redo them now because it's been a long gap, and a lot of it, you know, I didn't listen to for years and years, and then, you know, recently, because there have been conventions and all this sort of stuff and the revival of Doctor Who, I've rediscovered some of the music I wrote for Doctor Who, and my music making has moved on an awful long way since when I was doing that in the mid to late 80s. And I did a lot of electronic music in the 90s, a lot of dance music, techno, house music, that kind of stuff. And for me, this has been like bringing together two different aspects of my career. So my electronic dance music and my TV soundtrack music. And so, you know, it's a fantastic opportunity to blend the two together and try and create something, you know, a bit different and a bit new.
So in another unmistakably smooth segue, there's another gentleman who revisited his old work and changed it. That was a man called George Lucas. And where I'm going to now is that I'm contractually obliged by the podcast to ask you the question that gave it its name. And that question, Dominic, is Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Star Wars. It rings a bell. I would have to say Doctor Who. I think I'm just slightly the wrong age, Star Wars. Basically, Star Wars, you needed to be just maybe 3-4 years younger than me. My sci-fi film, which is the one I grew up with and the one that really had a big effect on my life and my influences musically and visually and, you know, what I'm into sci-fi wise, was 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, I was 7, I think, when that came out. And I remember going to the cinema and seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey, and that blew me away as a little impressionable 7-year-old. Now, had I been just a few years younger, the film that would have got me would have been Star Wars. And it's just, I think I've always went for the film that was slightly more out there, shall I say. I think my problem with Star Wars was really more that I felt it was a bit like sort of cowboys and Indians in space, whereas I like the kind of the science fiction ideas that were in 2001. So, you know, much as I have loved the Star Wars films, they haven't had the same impact on me as 2001. And I think with Doctor Who, I think, again, my age means that I grew up with Doctor Who, where I didn't grow up with Star Wars.
Excellent. Now, we're always really pleased when people give their time to come and talk to us. So if you've got a good cause you'd like to promote, Dominic, and everyone can go and have a look at it, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, nothing terribly original. I've got two things I would mention. One is your local cancer charity, probably Cancer Research, and I'd be very grateful if anyone was able to donate to them. Also, if anyone's slightly political, I'm particularly against the arms trade, and if anyone's interested in the campaign against arms trade, that's something else that people might want to have a look at, just in case they're interested in donating anything there as well.
That's brilliant. So, Dominic's new album, the Ravlox Remixes, out on the 18th of May, and people can still get the Gallifrey Remixes. Was the Doctor Who theme, wasn't it?
That's right.
And that's still available on iTunes and everything, isn't it, as well?
That's right, yeah, that's it.
And hopefully there's been some other things we've talked about, and you can go and have a look at Dominic's website and have a look at the long list of amazing things he's done and just realise how much of your life has come into your ears via him. So, Dominic, thank you very, very much for joining us.
That's a pleasure. And if anyone wants to look me up, yeah, dominiclynn.com, or find me on Facebook or Twitter or any of that old stuff. So, you know, I'm more than happy to say hi to anyone.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers, Andy.
Okay, Titan Comics, Doctor Who, 10th Doctor, number 10 review. Let's do this thing. Okay, so we've got a new story going on here. It's called Echo. We've got writer Robbie Morrison, who is great. newcomer artists, Eleonora Carlini, and for the colorists, Claudia SG and Incello. So, this issue starts with a bang, with its incredible cover. It's a simple but eye-catching series of radiating circles with the silhouette of the 10th Doctor in the front, and that silhouette is containing an exciting array of words that are onomatopoeias. You know, words that sound like what they are, like boom, crash, ram, etc. So, very visually striking cover. I liked it a lot. It kind of gave me like a Hitchcock feel to it too. And so the cover is just a taste of how awesome this issue is. I really loved everything about this issue, so I'll talk more about that. But first, here's a brief overview. So Gabby and the Doctor, they arrive back in New York safely after their terrifying encounter with the Weeping Angels during World War I. And so Gabby's busy reintegrating with her family. She missed them a lot, and being in the war zone like that made her really think about her family and the things that she's missed. And so while she's doing that, you start to notice the sound pollution everywhere is just starting to get crazy and out of control, and it is driving people insane. So eventually the Doctor outfits himself and Gabby with sonic earmuffs so they can withstand the sound. And they learn that these sounds that everyone is hearing are a cry for help from these giant, beautiful sonic whale thingies called echoes. And they're being hunted by these bizarre green-headed things that drive around in these silver transport things, and they're called shriekers. So the Doctor and Gabby, they escape on a green motorcycle, that was pretty awesome, onto the TARDIS. They use the sonic screwdriver and the Empire State Building to send a signal to neutralize the Shrieker's ship in outer space and to safely let the Echoes go free, which they are very grateful for. So I thought Robbie Morrison did a fantastic job with the writing. It felt very Doctor Who, very much like an episode you would watch on TV. And it felt very 10th Doctor. A lot of the things he said, really, you could hear David Tennant saying them. So great job, Robbie Morrison. And the art and the coloring in this issue are truly outstanding. The art has a very distinct style. It's a little more 2D than we're used to seeing with the 10th Doctor issues, and I really liked it. It really catches David Tennant's likeness in a good way, too. I'm very picky about my David Tennants, as you might know if you've heard a few of my past reviews. And then also, the way the artist uses the words in the story to depict the sound, I thought that was really clever and a really great use of words in an art form, especially a 2D art form. And so, like I mentioned before, it's the onomatopoeias. You see these throughout the streets and just in the city atmosphere. It's done in such a way that it almost gives you like this feeling of panic, like just all the chaos and everything, but in a good way. It's not like so bad that you're like, oh, I can't read this. But I thought that was really good, and it gives you a really good feeling of the noise pollution. So that was awesome. Oh, I also really liked the way the panels were laid out were really different than what we've seen, because they kind of go at different angles, and I thought it was a really fascinating layout. And I'm not sure if that's something the artist has a say in, or is that like the designer who does that? I wasn't really sure. But I liked it. I hope to see more layouts like that because it was really cool. Now the coloring of it. The coloring is so awesome too. It's a beautiful color palette that really nicely complements the artist's style. And especially the echoes, those whale thingies. They are just beautiful. If you just look at that page with those echoes on it, it's some of the most beautiful artwork I've seen in a comic book. Just gorgeous. And then also, back to the words that are depicting the sound pollution, they're kind of given like a different color that was really interesting and really unique and makes them stand out. So that was cool. Oh, and then another thing, the shriekers. Whenever they were talking or saying anything, their little bubbles were black instead of white. And so it was easy to tell the bad guys. And I thought that was pretty cool. I hadn't seen anything like that in a comic book before either. So yeah, a lot of really cool stuff happening in this. A couple of other things I really enjoyed in this issue. I think I mentioned in my last review I would really like to see Cindy. Well, we got to see her a little bit in this issue. She kind of fell victim to all the noise pollution at the beginning, but I think she's all right, and I think she's going to come back and play a bigger part. And then I really liked David Tennant saying, "Allons-y." So that was fun. I don't really remember seeing him saying that too much in these comics, but I think he probably should be saying that a lot more since that is his catchphrase. So overall, I really loved this issue. It was beautifully done, and it is Doctor Who through and through. So I give this one 9.5 Sonic Screwdrivers out of 10. So yeah, go out and get this 10th Doctor number 10. Go out to your local comic book store today, ask for it. You won't regret it. It was amazing. You'll definitely thank me later. All right, that's it for this review. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you.
It's the new Star Wars lightsaber from Kenner. Inflation required, batteries not included. You can pretend you have powers when you switch on Kenner's Star Wars lightsaber.
Ready to feel the Force? Yeah! Switch on your Star Wars lightsabers, close your eyes, and go! I got it! Me too! Zach, you passed the test! The Force is with you!
The Star Wars lightsaber, new from Kenner. Balloons not included.
And now we continue our Saturday morning viewing with Marvel's Adventures of Princess Leia. Following the destruction of her home planet of Alderaan, Princess Leia Organa, symbol of galactic hope and icon of the rebellion against the Galactic Empire, has vowed to collect all surviving Alderaanians, wherever they are and whatever the dangers. Aided on her mission by rebel pilot Yvonne Verlaine and her ever-faithful droid R2-D2, Leia must avoid the Imperial agents who would see her and the Alderaanians dead. All in the name of Alderaan. This week, Episode 3. The Preservers of Alderaan. You're listening to the Hoth Weather Station with the breaking weather news. The outlook for this weekend is snow, snow, snow. The Corellian Broadcasting Corps are denying rumors that Han Solo has signed a deal to feature in the new series of Kessel Shipping Wars. Solo's agents, Fame and Fortuna, and Tatooine have declined to comment.
Welcome to Just a Minute.
And don't forget, all you Dunsea dwellers, slip, slap, slop, and don't get sunsburn. You're listening to Rebel Heart Radio. Keep heart. We can now take you over for an exclusive with Royal Correspondent Usurge on Wayward Princess Leia Organa of the recently destroyed planet Alderaan. Hello, Oof.
Thank you, Tam. We're getting mixed messages about just what has happened to our rebellious rebel, Leia Organa. Losing one's planet is one thing, but losing one's dignity is another thing altogether.
So, Oof, can you confirm the rumors that Leia has left the sanctuary of the Rebel base and dropped out with Rebel pilot Yvonne Verlaine and a beat-up astromech droid?
Indeed, our intelligence informs us she is gathering a commune of Alderaanian survivors from around the galaxy.
So do you think ultimately she still sees herself as their princess and potential queen? Does she have what it takes to lead them?
Well, if the rumors of the bounty on her are anything to go by, the only thing she'll lead them to is death at the hands of the Empire.
Thank you. Ooh. Next, we look at the latest diet hitting the Outer Rim, the high-protein Tauntaun meat plan. Smelling bad on the inside is worth looking good on the outside.
Well, they aren't wrong over at Rebel Heart Radio. To all intents and purposes, Leia's behaviour in this continuing series from Marvel, to onlookers, may seem very odd. The most important symbol of the rebellion off around the galaxy, with a rebel pilot more steeped in the traditions and ways of Alderaan than our princess, and R2-D2. As I foresaw in issue 2, the Leia comic seems to have settled into a Saturday morning cartoon with an episodic formula. In issue 2, Leia rescues a group of musical Alderaanians from Naboo. There is a fracas with a baddie, and the rescued Alderaanians join the princess. In issue 3, we replace the naive artists with a group of bureaucratic civil servants in an enclave on the planet Sullust. They have, however, gone a little stir-crazy, which hasn't been helped by the destruction of their home world. Leia even points out to Ivan on a couple of occasions that they should be mindful of their own sanity. This links to my own theories I've voiced previously, suggesting that Leia's behaviour through the original trilogy does point to emotional issues. Could this story also be taking us in the same direction? I honestly hope that there is a rebel squadron not too far away, ensuring that Leia's year-out mercy mission isn't going to lead to her death. Of course, we know it ultimately doesn't, but there has to be a level of reality to protect the laid-back attitude and the sanity of the princess and those closest to her. I sense an outcome of tragedy in this mission. Although most of the cartoons I'm making my Leia comparisons with stuck to their formula, a few, such as Ulysses 31, did have an arc heading to a conclusion. The Leia comic also has this. In issue 2, we learnt that Tace, one of the rescued Alderaanians, was the sister of an Imperial officer, Tula, and they were in fact secretly communicating with each other on a daily basis. The Empire know every move Leia and her followers are going to make. An intercepted Imperial transmission makes the Alderaanians in issue 3 suspicious of Leia and doubt who she actually is. The Empire do indeed make it to Sullust, but the Stormtrooper's attack is thwarted by an AWOL R2-D2 in a speeder and a giant reptile called a Rockrender. Of course it was. By the end, of course, they are convinced Leia is there to rescue them. But Leia and Ivan are also aware there is a spy on board their convoy. The next step, to find the spy. The Saturday cartoon structure makes this comic incredibly accessible for fans of all ages and levels. And I have to say, it's an excellent entry comic for those wanting to indulge in Marvel's Star Wars comic universe. I'd especially recommend it as a family read, which is something we're going to revisit at the end of the series. So watch this space. If you're enjoying the Princess Leia comics and would like to win an exclusive one-off variant cover by promoting Rebel Heart Radio and Who Wars, then stay tuned to this channel.
Hello, Andy.
It's Al Noh, ladies and gentlemen. What are you doing here?
Lurking, mostly. I've just been in your comic wing.
All right.
Yeah, I was having a look at those top-shelf beauties, if you know what I mean. Say no more!
I've told you, you keep your hands off me, puppies and wows.
Yeah, anyway, I'm to let you know that Kate's hailing. Are we crossing franchises here?
What? Move us out of the storm so we can send a clear transmission.
Aye, aye, Chief.
Kate, what an unexpected surprise.
Enough with the pleasantries, Andy. How is the progression of the UK Who Wars Studios construction? Is it on schedule?
Well, it's slow, but it's just me, comic book John, and fan in the bath, and she can't touch the electric. She doesn't get out of the bath, you know. Well, if I could have more staff, perhaps.
I grow tired of your excuses, Andy. Perhaps you can ask Rob when he arrives.
Rob? Coming here? But what? Why?
Don't let me down, Andy. Rob is not as forgiving as I am.
Right, so that's Comic Book John, Fanning the Bath and Al Nurt in a nice neat line. I'll cut and paste a few more of them in later, make it look more imposing for the special edition. Astrid with me. Oh, Rob Shuttle's here. Hello, hello, hello. I'm very excited to welcome you, Rob. What is thy bidding?
Get up, Andy. You don't need to bother with all that. Hey, Andy. Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Star Wars?
What?
Doctor Who?
Just fooling. So what's happening with the studio construction, Andy? What with all those sensational interviews and Star Wars celebration in the UK next year? You can't keep bringing guests to your shed.
It'll be done. Don't worry. I've got a sponsor. Rebel Heart Radio have promised us 22 buckets of Lego to finish the build if we get them some promotion.
Rebel Heart Radio, mate? Those egomaniac raw reporters on your Princess Leia comic reviews?
That's them.
Well, I'm more of a Hoth Weather Station listener myself, but we can't afford to turn down the offer, I guess. Okay, Andy, do what you need to do. I've got to make a move. Cricket's about to come on, and if I'm gone too long, the Who Wars theme will change itself back.
No worries. Cheers, Rob.
Oh, and Andy, Star Wars or Doctor Who?
Star Wars.
What?
Doctor Who.
What?
Star Wars.
What?
Doctor Who.
Just fooling. See you around, Andy.
You're listening to Rebel Heart Radio. Keep heart. We're giving you the chance to win a one-off exclusive Rebel Heart Radio Who Wars cover variant of Issue 1 of Marvel's Princess Leia comic. Created by Who Wars' very own Andy, this hand-drawn image of Royal Correspondent Uwe Oosterch and myself, Tam 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 Tawana, has been created especially for the podcast.
In order to win this unique comic, simply go to the Who Wars iTunes page and rate and review the best Star Wars Doctor Who podcast for interviews, reports, features, and reviews. One lucky reviewer will then be selected randomly to win the comic on Sunday the 21st of June and will be announced on the following edition of Who Wars.
See the artwork? Hop over to whowars.net. And remember, keep heart!
Hello, Who Wars. I've been asked to review Kanan the Last Padawan, issue number 2 for you guys. And last week when this book came out, I was really anticipating it. I was really excited about it. I had hoped that it was going to come out sooner than it did, because we've got a few of these Star Wars comics coming out. Sometimes it feels like every 2 weeks, but this one was actually one they waited over a month for. I will say it's definitely worth the wait. It's probably, next to Darth Vader, it's my favorite Marvel Star Wars series right now. It has some great plot points that, I mean, this is stuff that we've never seen before. It's not even like other stuff, because we haven't had this Dark Times period drawn out and explained in a way very clearly. And so, if you remember from last time when I was reviewing issue 1, we know that Kanan, whose real name is Caleb Doom, was originally a Padawan of a Jedi Master, had been sent off to fight in the Clone Wars, and had ended up on a planet where they were just clearing out the last of the Separatist armies. And as they were about to sit down and go to bed for the evening, ended up having Order 66 happen. And so that was very frustrating last week, or last month when we discussed this, so I was waiting for this one, because I figured this would be the aftermath, and I wasn't wrong. It was right from the word go, we got Order 66, we got the hunt of the Jedi, and more to the point, unfortunately for Master Bilbala, we got her death scene, in which, as it was mentioned in Rebels, she told Kanan to run, which was her last words to him. So she is cut down by their associated clone force, and Caleb is now on the run and is now a outlaw. And so his first mission effectively is to survive, and they do a really good job of drawing out the fact that he doesn't really know how to do that. He was never trained to do anything in the way of survival. He was never trained in trying to make it on his own. He was effectively a monk. And all of a sudden now he's been thrown from being a monk to a general to now trying to make it on his own with no money, no food, no nothing. And if it wasn't for the kindness of a stranger that we saw at the beginning of the previous comic book who was rude to him, he would not have gotten as far as he does get in this book. So if you want to read more of it, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. I enjoyed a lot about this book. I really enjoy the art. It's actually really well done. I have to applaud them for how they've taken what we know and have drawn it a little stylistically, but it's still clear who everybody is. I think Wiseman has done a great job with his book, and I look forward to issue 3, which hopefully comes out relatively soon. But like I said before, between this and the Darth Vader comic, I love the Star Wars comics right now. And it'll be fun to kind of see how this grows past this and where we're going to go with Kanan now that he is free of the Jedi Order, but yet not necessarily free of problems. Anyway, Who Wars, we'll talk to you next month.
Hey, everybody. So, Marvel Star Wars number 4. It came out last month, but I haven't had a chance to get to it till now because of all the Star Wars Celebration stuff I did. But here's your review for that one. I hope you guys enjoy it. Really cool looking cover. It's got Darth Vader looking into the binary sunset. Who doesn't love that? And, you know, it's got this larger image of Darth Vader, you know, a front view of him. And I do think something's a little off about his helmet on that. Just something, I don't know, I can't place it. But overall, it's still a really cool cover. I like it a lot. And another minor note, at the beginning of each issue, you know, it's got the screen crawl like in the movies with the starfield in the background. But in the last couple issues, the stars have been too big and it's been really distracting trying to read the type against that. So they need to fix that. The first two issues, it was fine. The stars were smaller and there wasn't that contrast problem, but it's really annoying and it's hard to read that text. So I really think that they should fix that. Okay, so that's just a minor thing. So getting to the story. So here we kind of see everybody's ending up on Tatooine. Tatooine is so important in the Star Wars universe. Maybe we'll find out more about this as more events take place there. But anyway, Darth Vader, he's on Tatooine trying to negotiate with Jabba to try to help resupply the Empire since the weapons facility's been destroyed and the Death Star's been destroyed. All the Rebel crew, they reconvene. Admiral Akbar and Mon Mantha, they want to slow down. They think everybody's, like, going crazy, but Leia doesn't think they should slow down. She thinks they should keep attacking. Then Luke, we've got him. He's getting all whiny again and frustrated because the Force, he doesn't know what to do with himself, and he doubts his power after he was so easily defeated by Vader. And so he's heading off in his little X-Wing with R2 as his co-pilot, off to Tatooine to find some answers. Now on Tatooine, we find this really cool, mysterious, masked bounty hunter, who I presume is a woman, and all you can see is her eyes. She's got this really interesting looking mask over her face, and a really cool hood, and she's very mysterious. And so she's looking for Han. Very interesting. And she's trying to get some information from some Rodians who are not being helpful. So she shoots them all in the knees. She's pretty brutal. So it seems like she's trying to find Han. Maybe it's personal. Maybe it's like an ex-girlfriend or something like that. I don't know. I'm really curious to see how that one plays out. Yeah, then we see Vader. He is trying to glean more information about Obi-Wan and Luke. He's trying to piece all the pieces together. And then this issue ends with the one and only Boba Fett. He is trying to get information about Luke via Obi-Wan. So that last issue ended with that box being delivered to Obi-Wan's residence, and it had said on it, "For Luke." So I'm sure we're going to start seeing all of these different plot lines come together in the next issue. So that's exciting. So there was a lot of stuff I liked about this one. You know, it was a lot less action than we have been seeing in the last couple issues. It's kind of like a breather. You can't have that high-level intensity all the time with a comic book, or with any medium, really, TV, movies. You gotta kind of, it's like a roller coaster. It goes up, it goes down. So, yeah, this was definitely one of the lulls. Another thing I liked, looks like Darth Vader hates Salacious B. Crumb as much as I do. There was a really funny panel referencing that. I thought that was hilarious because I can't stand Salacious B. Crumb. Probably my least favorite character in Star Wars of all time. So yeah, Darth Vader gets me. And then that rogue bounty hunter. She's awesome. I'm assuming she's a woman, by the way. If you look, I think you would probably agree she's a woman. But I think she's really cool. I love the look. And I think it'd be really awesome to cosplay as her, actually. That'd be really fun. And speaking of cosplay, I may or may not be cosplaying as Aphra at Phoenix Comic Con in a few weeks. You'll have to wait and see. Okay, so what else did I like in here? You know, I mentioned about the binary sunset earlier. The binary sunset gets me every time. You know, it was on the cover, and then there's this scene towards the end. Jabba's kind of saying, well, there's been nobody born of importance on Tatooine. Then Darth Vader is just standing there, looking off into the binary sunset with the reflection on his eyes. So that was definitely a really beautiful panel, and kudos to the artist for that one. You know, and then last but not least, Boba Fett. I always love seeing Boba Fett. He is so awesome. And it's going to be cool to see him in these series a little more. And for the record, I'm totally on board for a Boba Fett anthology film. That's my stance on that. I don't think you can ever get enough Boba Fett. Yeah, overall, I feel like even though this was kind of like a lull episode, the writing and art, they're still really good. You can always tell which character is supposed to be who, and especially the writing for Han is spot on. You can just totally hear Harrison Ford saying those words. So yeah, I still think the writing and the art's there. Just was a little bit lighter episode. So I'll give this one a 7.5 lightsabers out of 10. All right, so the next one actually comes out fairly soon. I think maybe 2 weeks. So maybe in the next episode, you might be hearing my next review for Star Wars number 5. Allons-y, and may the Force be with you. So, did everyone have a good Star Wars day on May 4th? I sure did. It was a lot of fun. Not only did I tweet like a maniac pretty much the whole day, but then that evening, I got to go to a bookstore where they were having a book signing of the Ultimate Star Wars, and authors Adam Bray and Trisha Barr were there. So I got to have my book signed by them and got to meet them, and even got to ask them a few things for Who Wars, which you'll also hear in this episode. But also, members of the 501st, the Dunsea Garrison, were there, so I had a lot of fun just interacting with those guys and talking to them and finding out more about the 501st and the process of the costumes that they make. And yeah, it was really interesting. And so without further ado, here are some of the members of the 501st, the Dunsea Garrison here in Arizona. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your costume?
Yeah, well, I'm with the 501st, the Dunsea Garrison. We're the Arizona branch of the 501st Legion. We're a non-profit charity group. We do a lot of charity events, children's hospitals, we'll do promotional stuff, Phoenix Suns, Rattlers, and today awesome. We're doing a Lucasfilm event.
Very cool.
Our costumes are all handmade.
Very nice.
We'll make them ourselves. And
very cool.
hardcore, pretty much hardcore Star Wars fans.
That's cool. Do you have any other things you dress up as?
I have a Stormtrooper, and I'm also working on an Old Republic Havoc Trooper from the Old Republic video game.
Very cool.
And then I'm working on a Weequay Skiff Guard from Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
And possibly a Clone Trooper after that.
Very cool. Who's your favorite Star Wars character?
I'd probably say IG-88.
Oh, nice. That's a good one. I've never gotten that one before.
I love the bounty hunter. I was three when Star Wars came out.
Yeah.
So it's been my entire
life.
Nice.
Did you hear about the Boba Fett spinoff news today?
No. Is that
That's what the second one is supposed to be.
That is?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It was only a matter of time.
Yeah.
They announced that the director was fired.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
Quit, fired.
Right. Were you at Celebration?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when they said he was sick.
Yeah, he wasn't sick. He was calling it fired.
My name is TK61281 with the First Order.
Uh-huh. All right. That's one of the new Stormtroopers, by the way.
Yes.
My name is TK21619, Dune Sea Garrison.
TK32478 with the Dune Sea Garrison.
Awesome.
71114.
No, sir. Move along.
Also, TK21619 is also known as TK Popcorn.
Okay. So, do you guys want to tell me a little bit about, like, the process of doing your costumes?
Oh, well, let's see. It all goes back to when we were a child.
A lot of spit and duct tape.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
Like,
you basically find everything you have in your garage and use it to make one of these. It's a lot of cutting, a lot of gluing, sanding, sometimes Bondo work. Stitching, snapping, rivets.
So, like, what the actual, like, armor, what is that?
ABS plastic?
Yeah.
So it's vacuum formed.
Where do you get that
at? Molds, like, and then they vacuum form it into shapes, and then we cut it out and shape it.
There's various suppliers around the world.
Okay.
So you really have to be able to get onto the internet and learn to know people.
Okay.
It's very forum driven. It's very, 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 compilation.
Very
you got to know people. Everybody's worked on everybody's armor.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
We're with the 501st, so we've been making these screen accurate suits for years. So we've got forums and all kinds of resources that people can use to learn how to make them.
So, like, with the new Stormtrooper, when did you first start working on that?
Oh, about a month ago.
Because we didn't really see the official things until the first teaser, right?
Yeah, I wore it the first day they revealed it. So the 501st got the opportunity to make these in advance, which was cool, but
that's
it also
awesome.
Meant making it in secret.
Oh,
so we
yeah.
didn't even get to see the trailer shots while we were making it. So.
Oh, wow.
But because the 501st does such a good job, they brought us in to make
that's
some
so cool.
suits. So it's all part of the marketing.
I was wondering about that. That's cool. Are there any Chrome Troopers in the works? Hi.
I'm sure there are. There's always someone working on something. So.
That's cool.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, I'll let you guys move along.
All right.
Move along.
Thanks.
We're good at that.
Thank
all right.
You.
Who are, if you guys want to listen? Okay. You guys want to say who your costumes are?
I'm a Tusken Raider.
Uh-huh.
I'm Clone Trooper Echo.
Awesome. So what made you choose the costumes that you guys went with?
For me, it was a cheap, inexpensive costume to start out.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was a matter of looking for something that the kids would recognize, so I went with the animated series.
That's cool. That's nice. So, did you do anything special for the handprint? Like, is it actually painted?
It's
like, it's not
painted.
Like an actual.
It's all hand-painted.
That's cool. Awesome. So, do you guys do any Star Wars impressions other than the characters you're dressed as?
Not really.
No.
Everybody does a Vader.
Yeah, that's it.
Go ahead. Any Chewbaccas?
Not a good one.
I know, it's hard to get a good
one. I think that Chewbacca kind of runs into my Tusken Raider.
Oh yeah, can you do the Tusken Raider thing? Awesome. Thanks. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the 501st, they are some awesome Star Wars fans, and I never get tired of talking to them. And even though it was Star Wars Day, I managed to get some Doctor Who conversation in there too. That first guy, the Scout Trooper, turns out he's a big Doctor Who fan, and he had a few thoughts on Series 8.
Huge fan. I grew up in England, so I was born with Doctor Who, but I felt they did so much work on the 50th anniversary special with Gallifrey existing, and they just barely touched on
it in season eight.
Yeah. I feel like they basically teased more of the vintage Doctors coming back with a few familiar faces, and I felt like they did such a great job on the 50th anniversary when I went to the theater to see it. I saw it in 3D.
Right.
And then season eight kind of just glossed over it.
Yeah, and then at the end, like, that was weird.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
With the master saying, or Missy saying she knew the coordinates or whatever, but it wasn't there.
Right, yeah. And then,
yeah, I thought that was odd.
I don't know. I kind of just felt season eight was going through the motions.
They
built up so much potential with the 50th anniversary.
It seemed like Clara is kind of over past her due, too.
She went from a really strong, really impossible girl to a love smitten.
Yeah.
I don't know. They basically completely changed her character.
Yeah.
She lost all of her strength. When they introduced Mr. Pink, I think they made her character weak.
Yeah.
And she lost a lot of the clout that they really built up her character.
Right.
And I said she was the impossible as well.
Yeah.
And now she's this doe eyed character. And I said, you kind of lost the plot with her. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm hoping the next season picks up again. I mean, I think there's a lot of potential with Peter Cavalli. I just don't think he's really captive.
I like him as a doctor,
I was a little reserved at first.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, definitely a deviation from where they've been going.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll get it back on track.
Yeah.
I mean, I know ratings were down last season, especially in England. Because they put it later on at night, more adult themes. And, I don't know, I think.
Yeah, there was
it's
some
got
pretty
some mileage left. I've loved the reboot.
That's cool. So, who's your favorite doctor?
Probably Tennant. I think he was.
Me too. High five.
He was born to play that role. David Tennant.
Yeah, he's definitely my favorite.
Yeah, because there was rumors he was coming back as the aftermath with the reason which had come
to the
bodies.
I thought they should have brought. Remember, you know, there was like the duplicate one. They should have brought him back as a companion.
Yeah,
that would have been cool.
Yeah,
that would have been really funny.
Would have done too.
See, need to hire me as a writer.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know. I'm hoping season 9 gets back on.
Yeah, it's interesting. Nothing else.
Thanks again to the 501st Legion, the Dune Sea Garrison. You guys rock, and hopefully I'll see some of you guys at the Phoenix Comic Con in a few weeks. So I hope everyone had an awesome Star Wars day. May the 4th be with you always.
Well, here we are at the end of the 31st Who Wars. My thanks to Kate, Andy and John for their submissions this episode. I certainly had a lot of fun as the pieces flowed in over the past couple of weeks, listening to them and thinking, wow, this is going to be some episode. And I hope you enjoyed listening to it too, wherever you might be, in your bedroom or study, your car, your class at school or university. Look out, you're being watched. On the beach or wherever you might be. But tell you what, there's something in the next episode that will blow you all away. Well, the Who fans at least. But I'll tell you more about that after this episode's back page editorial. Let's go. On a recent episode of the Doctor Who podcast, Diddly Dum, the show flew solo with only one host for a change, and it was one of the new chums too, Hayden, at the helm. He was talking to people about their experiences at Longleat in 1983, and if you don't know what that was, think the Woodstock for Doctor Who. It was basically a weekend where everyone piled into the countryside to celebrate Doctor Who at this old estate for the 20th anniversary of the show. There was cast and crew, both former and present, and costumes and sets and panels and displays and all the kind of stuff that a modern convention goer might think, ah, oh, yeah? But for the time, it was extraordinary, and even more extraordinary were the numbers of people who went, and the queues, and all sorts of good stuff. I remember reading about Longleat around 1987, I think in the Peter Haining reference book, Doctor Who, A Celebration, and thinking many things, but primarily how much fun it would have been to attend, and secondarily how long ago it seemed to me. Of course, I was only 12 years old at the time and thinking about something that had happened 4 years earlier, basically one third of my life on this planet at that time, seemed a stupidly long time ago. Of course, I sit here now talking about Longleat being 32 years ago, and that number just doesn't compute. It makes no sense to me. I just can't conceive that this event I used to think about happening 4 years earlier is now positively ancient. You know, it's a decade older than some of our Who Wars contributors. It's crazy stuff. But believe it or not, I'm not here to talk about Longleat. You see, during the conversation, there was discussion about meeting Doctor Who people and getting autographs and what modern cons are like, and although I wouldn't describe it as grumbling from either Hayden or the guest he was speaking to, which was Lee Rawlings from the Blue Box podcast, there was certainly talk about how cons work these days and the fees involved for getting up close and personal with the stars. Lee mentioned, for example, that his favourite thing to do is just to shake hands with the stars and say they meant a lot to him, or, you know, whatever his message might be, which I find quite charming, and I'm sure the stars genuinely like that sort of thing, especially if they aren't being asked for a selfie, which seems to be the main bugbear of celebrities these days. Indeed, I've heard some celebrities say recently they'd rather sign something than pose for selfies. I think they miss the days of signing things sometimes. But getting back to the topic, I've always found the concept of paying for autographs to be an interesting one. You see, on one hand, I can totally understand when people say, why should I pay for an autograph? If I walked up to, say, Peter Davison on the street, he'd surely just sign something for me, wouldn't he? He wouldn't pull out a wireless credit card machine and try and charge me. And that's completely true. If you meet a star from Doctor Who, for example, one-on-one, and you aren't at the urinal or interrupting their dinner or basically making an ass of yourself in some way, I can almost guarantee that most, if not all of them, would happily give you a signature and maybe a kind word free of charge. So what happens at conventions? Why are they different? Why do the same people become, in the eyes of some fans at least, money-grabbing, keep-everyone-at-arm's-length unless they've coughed up some cash merchants? The answer really has two parts. First and most importantly, charging a fee does keep the numbers down. If you have 1,000 people at a con, for example, there's no way a doctor or companion can sign 1,000 autographs in the time they've got allotted for autographs. Or more than that, if fans are taking multiple items, putting a cash value on each signature immediately takes away the people who refuse to pay, and even knocks down the number of items others will get signed if they have to start paying for each item. The second part of the answer is that, yes, let's just say it, for some actors and crew from Doctor Who, the money they make from autographs is a handy income stream. No ifs or buts about it. The convention circuit isn't referred to as the gravy train by some for nothing. Now, it's not their only income stream, of course. They are paid for being at the con in the first place, in most circumstances, and they have residuals from their old shows, and they may still have TV or theatre work. But make no mistake, signing a few hundred items at X number of dollars or pounds per pop, and getting a decent chunk of the money from that, really does add up. And if it's all cash in hand, does it get declared in tax? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. It would have to depend on the individual in each case, I would wager. Moving along, I recall the Diddly Dum piece had either Hayden or Lee talking about how paying for autographs also seemed new to them, or newish, like a new thing on the convention circuit. Maybe in some ways it is. However, I have clear memories of Mark Strickson and his wife at the time, Julie Brennan, who were, of course, Turlough from Doctor Who, and Julie was one of the Red Kangs, if I recall correctly, in a Sylvester McCoy story, Paradise Towers. They appeared at Console 88 here in Sydney, held in 1988, funnily enough, and they certainly charged for autographs then. I guess in some ways, too, which I didn't mention earlier, you're also paying for the photograph as well. You know, they're not just going to sign photographs for free, I guess. And you know, I still have both of those signatures here, somewhere. I really should try and find them. So, do I have an issue with paying for autographs? No. Certainly if I rub shoulders with a past doctor in a pub or someone from Star Wars down at the local mall and said, hey, could you sign this, and held out a beer coaster or a napkin or something, and they said to me, oh, give me a tenner and I will, I'd call BS on that. But I've not heard of that ever happening, and the likelihood just seems so remote as to be ridiculous. So, in the confines of a convention, meanwhile, where the number of autograph hunters must be confined to certain numbers, and where photographs have to be provided to be signed, and where the actor is there to, again, let's not mince words, make a buck, I don't have a problem with it. In a similar way with convention packages which might contain a dinner or a meet and greet, I see no issue with paying to get into those. Again, it can't be offered to everyone for free, or even a limited number for free due to the inherent unfairness of that. So money does become, as in so many other aspects of our lives, the thing that separates the haves from the have-nots. It sounds so terrible to break it down like that, but it doesn't make it any the less true. Here in Australia, back when I was working in communications for a large movie house, I had a lot of contacts, and one of them was the guy who runs large conventions around Australia. Through him, I got to attend a lot of conventions in many different states, VIP parties and the like for free. So I've certainly seen a lot of this sort of thing without having to pay, so I feel I can make the call on whether it's worth it or not. And I guess the answer is, it depends on how big of a fan you are in the first place, and maybe more importantly, your personality. I was at a VIP party one year, for example, with my wife in tow, and we stood there having a few drinks, talking to people we knew from the convention team and other people we knew from fandom who'd paid the, you know, $1,000 to be there, or whatever the ticket price was. And to the left and right of us were people from shows and movies we really liked. But you know what? Even though we were there, and they were there, and we'd had a few drinks, so Dutch courage was certainly in abundance, and their whole reason for being there was to be nice to the people who'd paid the lion's share for them to be there in the first place, neither my wife or I were inclined to speak to them. Honestly, I felt like I would be bothering them with mindless small talk. In many ways, I wanted to still think of them as their character from the small screen or the big screen, and not really feel like I'd made a fool of myself with them, or had them tell me something weird or inappropriate that would then make me feel weird about the show or movie that I love them in. Speaking of, I won't name the person, or even whether they were from film or TV, but at another VIP night I attended, said person and I got chatting. I don't know how, as you can see, I don't actually like approaching actors and stuff like this. And they said the dirtiest thing to me ever. Now, it wasn't about me, mind you. It wasn't anything bad directed at me. It was something they wanted to do to other people in the room and their thoughts on how they would do that. I'm trying to be very delicate in describing this situation, and that's probably all I can say. But you know what? Neither my wife or I can see this person in anything now, because naturally I told my wife what was said within minutes of it happening, without us both remembering that time. You know, they say never meet your heroes, and although this person was never a hero, per se, not at all, they're still someone we'd watch, and their reputation with us is now forever changed due to that meeting. But to get back on track, if you have a big personality and you aren't as self-aware as some, and you can walk into a VIP party and see someone from Buffy or Star Wars or Twilight or Torchwood or Stargate or Doctor Who or whatever the show might be, and walk up to them and say, "Woo, you're in my hometown, you rock, give me a high five, how about a selfie, want to dance?" You know, and basically get right into it, then sometimes spending that $500 or $1,000 or whatever the VIP event might be money well spent. You know, you'll have pictures and stories and a hangover perhaps to last a lifetime, and you might think that's tops. For many others, however, even some people who do cough up the cash for these things and do it year after year, I think they can be a real waste of time, and you won't really get out of them what you thought you might. Indeed, someone paying the general con admission and lining up for a photo might get a similar amount of memories and interaction with their chosen celeb for a lot less moolah. So, is it right or wrong? I think that's a really subjective thing. If you're right into someone or something and will get genuine pleasure from spending money on a photo or an autograph or a party or the ability to sit in the front row of their talk, then go for it. Life's too short for regrets, and if it gives you pleasure and doesn't hurt anyone else, do it. I mean, that's my philosophy about most things in life, by the by. If, on the other hand, that's not your scene, well, I don't need to encourage you not to do it because you probably aren't going to do it. And that's my point of view on cons and autographs and the exchange of money when it comes to meeting our heroes. What do you think? Why not write into us at hello@whowars.net or even send an MP3? And we'll use it on the show. All right. And on that note, I think we can call a wrap on episode 31. See you in episode 32 with a current New Who writer being interviewed. Yep, you heard that correctly. A current New Who. And by New Who, I mean TV episodes, not comics or audios or anything like that. I mean someone working with Stephen Moffat right now on Series 9. We'll be talking to them in episode 32. Are you excited yet? See you in 2 weeks, everyone.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of Who Wars. If you'd like to be in touch with the show, simply email hello@whowars.net. Find us on Twitter @WhoWars or if Facebook's more your thing at facebook.com/WhoWars. Oh, and don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. See you next time.